The Solomonster sounds off.
My client, Brock Lesnar, conquered the streak.
This doesn't make any sense.
Your title belt is made of leather. You're not a real vegan.
I'm fat. You haven't been beat up properly. Woo!
Welcome to episode 345 of the Solomonster Sounds Off podcast here for Sunday, September 14, 2014. I am the Solomonster. Thank you for downloading the podcast, listening, and streaming wherever you may be through the Solomonster.com, iTunes, Stitcher Radio, TuneIn Radio. I had one of our listeners, Junkyard Jerry, write into me yesterday. He said that he discovered the podcast through Dogcatcher, which is an Android podcatcher app. It's pretty big, apparently. So if you are an Android user and you don't already have the official Sound Off app downloaded for some reason, first of all, what are you waiting for? Second of all, you can get our feed through Dogcatcher, so no excuse not to tune into the podcast each and every week. I also want to thank a whole bunch of people here for making PayPal donations. You could do so on thesolomonster.com. Again, this is a free podcast I bring to you every week. If you would like to show your support and make a donation, you may do so through our website. You'll see the PayPal box on the right-hand side. $10 or more will get you a wrestling nickname. I want to say thank you to Chuck Lunatic Lentz, who has been a longtime fan of the show. Very much appreciate his support. Razorblade Trevor Johnson, Nash the Gravedigger Degalado, Muhammad the Mutilator Askar, Tori All I Do Is Win Johansson, Craig Pitbull Brown, Ladies Man Levi Daly, Brass Tacks Elliot Johnson, Gerald Battleaxe Broussard, Tyler Bling Bling Biller. I hope you get some of that for your birthday next week, buddy. Joshua the Demon Kane. I just had to. Who donated, by the way, and bought a Sound Off shirt in our store. So a double thank you to him. Also, Howard Kroom, longtime supporter of the podcast. He bought a t-shirt this week as well. Lauren Spector is going to be walking around with his very own Sound Off shirt, too. So, again, if you want to make a PayPal donation, you could do so on thesolomonster.com. But, yeah, we also have the brand new store on prowrestlingtees.com. It's been up for about a week. Thank you again to those of you who already bought a shirt. If you are one of the first 25 people, I guess now down to 22 slots left. If you buy a shirt, you will get a shout-out here on the podcast. It's key that if people are going to buy shirts, you do so sooner rather than later, because the quicker we move a certain number of shirts, we'll be able to add more designs, we'll be able to maintain the store, pretty much put up, you know, whatever new designs that we want, and we have a whole bunch, you know, that we're working on right now, so... ProWrestlingTees.com/Solomonster Sounds Off is the direct URL to our store. Please do check out the four designs we have up right now and consider buying a shirt. That would help us out a great deal. I want to mention something I did this weekend before we get into everything here, and there is a lot to get into. But I posted on Twitter, and some of you sounded kind of interested in it. I did an event yesterday, last night here in New York, called Trapped in a Room with a Zombie. Which, when I first heard about this, it sounded very interesting, and I'm into all that kind of zombie, horror, Halloween-type shit anyway, as a lot of you guys know. October's my favorite month because of that. And so I heard about this, and there were a few friends who wanted to do it, and I said, sure, count me in. And the way it works is, now I have to preface this by saying, this is not, you know, a haunted house. This is not one of those Halloween deals that they, you know, dredge up every October, where it's meant to be scary and shocking and disgusting and all that kind of stuff. It really isn't meant to be scary at all, although for some people I could see how it would be. The way it works is you have a person, an actor, whoever, dressed as a zombie, makeup and all from head to toe. And in this case, she was actually a pretty hot zombie, I have to say. We had a female zombie. She is chained to the wall, chained to the inside of a closet that, you know, maybe it works differently in different cities. They have it in New York, they have it in Chicago, LA, they may have it in Atlanta, I'm not sure. So the zombie is chained to a wall, let's say, and you have 60 minutes. You are deadbolted into a room with up to 11 other people. Some of them may be friends, some of them may be strangers. They usually try to fill it up with 11 or 12 people no matter what. I think we had 10 half of which were people I knew, half of which were total and complete strangers. My strategy going into this was to earn their trust. I said to all my friends, let's meet these people, let's introduce ourselves, earn their trust, and then when the time is right, we'll just push them into the zombie. And they seemed to like that strategy, although I have to say the people who were in the room with us were very helpful. So my strategy shifted at some point to, let's let them help us, and when they get all the clues, then we can push them into the zombie. Didn't quite work out that way. We did not escape the room in time. Our 60 minutes expired. We came close. You have to solve a series of clues and find different combinations to locks where things are locked up. And when you put all the clues together, I mean, it's actually pretty complicated. It's more of a brain teaser. You think of like a murder mystery kind of thing. They have that kind of stuff. And the zombie is there, and every 5 minutes, the chain is loosened a little bit more. And the idea is you have to avoid the zombie at all costs. If the zombie touches you, you know, bites you, you're eliminated. You have to go sit in the corner. You can verbally help your team, but you can no longer physically participate. So I'm happy to say, if nothing else, I didn't get bitten. I did jump up on the table at one point, and I learned that apparently the zombie cannot touch or see things on top of the table. And so that was my safe haven for a few minutes there at the end as I tried to unlock something that was just completely unlockable. It's not easy. I think they said they have like a 24% rate of success here in New York of people who escape within 60 minutes. It was a lot of fun. So if that's the sort of thing you think you might be into, look it up. I mean, if you're in New York, I would definitely, you know, recommend checking it out. And maybe they have something similar in your city. RoomEscapeAdventures.com is the website. If you want to check it out, you'll find all the information there. And if it is in your city, you can sign up from there. It really is more about team building, problem solving, using your brain, and it just so happens that there's a zombie chained to the wall that you have to contend with. Sean O'Hare passed away this past week, as you're all aware of by now, 43 years old, former WCW and WWE superstar. He was found with a rope around his neck tied to a bedpost, so believed to have been a suicide. I think they found him on Monday morning, I believe. And according to TMZ, he had a really bad addiction to alcohol. He had been to WWE-sponsored rehab 6 times in the past 6 years, including earlier this year, I guess was his last stint there. And after that, the company tried to keep in touch with him, and he just fell off the face of the earth, and nobody knew where he was. And they lost communication with him until they found his body this past week. And, you know, he's one of those guys, Sean O'Hare, who at the very tail end of WCW, they finally tried to start pushing a lot more younger talent. And they had, you know, him and Mark Jindrak were a team, and they did the whole New Blood against the Millionaires Club angle, which was not the worst angle in the world. You can argue the execution sucked. But that's the sort of thing they should have been doing years earlier. With all that talent they had, you know, during the Monday Night Wars when that was still going on, they just did such a piss-poor job of building up new stars that a lot of those guys bolted the first chance they got. Chris Jericho, The Big Show, who, believe it or not, used to be young. We had, you know, Benoit and Malenko and Saturn and Eddie Guerrero, all of these great stars that defected over to WWE because they couldn't take it anymore, and they knew that they were never going to get above a certain level in WCW. So they lost a lot of those young stars. They only made one star, really. I mean, you could say, I guess, DDP as well, but Goldberg was the only real big-time star they made during that era, and it came back to bite them on the ass, and by the end it was too late. But he came along at a time when they were starting to push younger guys. He had a great look. You know, he's this big jacked-up dude, seemed pretty athletic and had a good look to him. Eric Bischoff was actually a big fan of O'Hare's. He had big plans for him because Bischoff thought he had WCW bought. He had the backers, the investors. They were going to buy WCW. They had a whole big press conference announcing that they were buying WCW, except when TV got shit-canned by Jamie Kellner at Turner and there was no television anymore, the investors pulled out and Bischoff was left standing there looking like a schmuck, and he couldn't buy the company anymore because without TV, the company was worthless. But had Bischoff continued on with his plans, the idea was that WCW would go dark for at least a few weeks, maybe even a couple of months, and they would relaunch. And apparently he had big plans for O'Hare. I don't want to say O'Hare would have been the top guy, but he was going to get a big, big push as a single star under a Bischoff-led WCW, and that never came to be. That was the first instance of O'Hare being a victim of timing. Not just the Piper stuff, which came later on, which we'll get to in a second. came over to WWE after the purchase of WCW, and they just never did anything with him. And when they finally appeared to be doing something with him, they, you know, gave him this character where he, I guess he was kind of a play off the Al Pacino character in Devil's Advocate, and even, you know, he was a devil character. That's what he was. And I'm not telling you something you don't already know. And he would try to get people to do a lot of really bad shit. And it was an intriguing gimmick. I thought the vignettes, which you can find on YouTube, were pretty interesting. It wasn't your average standard pro wrestler vignette. And they paired him off with Rowdy Roddy Piper. So you would think, wow, this guy's got a, you know, a big push coming. He's being paired off with one of the greatest stars of all time, one of the biggest names in wrestling. And Piper was feuding with Hulk Hogan as Mr. America at that time. And I think Zach Gowen was involved. He was paired off with Hogan as well. And then Piper went and he did an interview for HBO Real Sports where he was very raw and honest in his feelings on how the wrestling business chews you up and spits you out, and a lot of the young guys, you know, his fellow comrades who have died, and it was really depressing. I mean, a lot of what Piper said was true, you know, and I'm sure he did feel that way, but it was not the sort of thing that WWE wanted to have one of their performers on HBO talking about, a lot of dead wrestlers, so they fired him. And unfortunately, when they fired Piper, that affected O'Hare because his push just stopped cold, just dead in its tracks. And I never really understood why. I don't know what one had to do with the other. You know, just because Piper wasn't around doesn't mean you couldn't continue with the vignettes and just have him doing that character on his own. He didn't need Roddy Piper. You know, it's not like he needed Piper and without him the character fell apart. The character could have been pushed even without Roddy Piper there, so I don't really know what happened there. I don't know if there was some political shit going on behind the scenes, or maybe he had a bad reputation, and so that was their excuse. Well, Piper's gone, so fuck this guy. We're not going to do anything with him. I just don't know. And who knows how big he could have gotten. After that, they really didn't do anything with him. He was there for a while. I think they sent him back down to developmental, and I think it was in 04 they cut him. And that was the last time he was ever employed by WWE. After that, I think he wrestled other places. He did some MMA or kickboxing, and he didn't do too well. He got into a lot of trouble. He would fight with people all the time, just get into like bar fights, and there were a lot of allegations from, I think, multiple women, ex-girlfriends, that he had, you know, beaten them up and stuff. Although I think in most or all of those cases, the charges were dropped, but again, where there's smoke, there's fire. Let's just say he did a lot of bad shit, and he fell on a lot of tough times, and he didn't do a lot of stuff that I would consider to be role model behavior. But how much of that was due to his addictions and whatever demons he may have had, who knows? You know, he went to rehab 6 times in 6 years, so some part of him obviously wanted help, and to see his story end this way is very sad. Because, yeah, he had potential and all that, but at the same time, there's another young wrestler, dead, 43 years old, another guy that's not going to see his 50th birthday, and that sucks. There was a big story that got posted a few days ago on the website, therap.com, which is an entertainment news site, pretty reliable website. I've read stories on there before, non-wrestling related, and they had an exclusive. They ran with this exclusive story, which talked about how Warner Brothers was in talks to acquire the entire WWE tape library, which when I read that, it made no sense. It just seemed way too far-fetched. Like, why would WWE even surrender control of their own tape library? The only thing that would ever make sense is if one day Vince just says, you know what, we got this massive offer from a Warner Brothers or a Disney, and we're going to sell the whole company, which I can't ever see happening. Even that, to me, is completely far-fetched. I just don't see that ever happening. Then and only then would I see the tape library falling into somebody else's hands. Otherwise, it makes absolutely no sense for them to even consider giving up control of their tape library because they're control freaks. I can think of few other companies as big of a control freak as WWE is. I mean, they control everything. They want to control your name. They want to control your identity. They want to control their own content. They just launch their own network, which is filled with hours and hours of their own footage that they're free to do with whatever they please. So why would they surrender that to another company? It doesn't make any sense. But The Wrap, again, is a somewhat reliable site, and you read that and you think to yourself, well, maybe things are worse than we all thought with the network, and you know they are looking to cut $40 million from the budget between now and next year, so who knows? Well, as it turns out, the story is not exactly accurate. It sounds like the writer probably is not all that familiar with WWE or pro wrestling, got her lines mixed up, and it's not so much an issue of they're negotiating a sale of the entire tape library as much as it sounds like they're negotiating a possible new distribution deal. Right now, WWE has a deal or a relationship with a company called Cinedigm to distribute their DVDs and home videos, and that may shift over to Warner Brothers. They've worked with Warner Brothers before, I think, on the Scooby-Doo movie to put that out, so they have that relationship there already. I think the head of Cinedigm a couple of months ago made some bad comments, but he made comments to the effect of the relationship with his company and WWE may not last much longer. And it's not that shocking, really, because if you're, you know, a distributor, if you're a company like Cinedigm working with WWE, and all of a sudden they're migrating to this network. So if you're a pay-per-view distributor, you're already pissed at WWE. If you're a DVD distributor, you're probably not too happy with them either, because the more that the more content they push to this network, the more, yeah, it's going to affect things like DVD sales and stuff like that. Why are people going to go out and spend $15, $20, $30, whatever it is for a DVD when they can just get that on the network? Although they're not pushing the DVDs to the network right away, but I think eventually that's probably what's going to happen. So, you know, the Paul Heyman DVD came out, and you can't find it on the network, but 3 years from now, let's say Paul Heyman gets a second DVD, and I'm just throwing that out there as an example, wouldn't it be nice if simultaneously it aired on the network, or it popped up in the VOD library on the network? That's the sort of thing they're going to have to do more of if they want to draw people into this network. You've got to give people an incentive to spend their money every single month, and that would be one way of doing it, but you're going to cannibalize your DVD business if you do that. So that's the story on that. The story is, there is no story. Monday Night Raw this past week was the season premiere. Did you know that Raw was the season premiere on Monday night? Because I didn't know that. I don't think they told us enough times. I think the best part about Raw this Monday, what I'm looking forward to the most about Raw this upcoming Monday night, is that it's not the season premiere. That, I think, is the number one reason to look forward to this week's show. It's comical. They want so badly for people to look at Raw like they would look at any other show on television. Any other show that has a season premiere and a season finale. But that's the worst thing they could want you to do. Because if you judge that, if you judge Raw and its season premiere and its season finale against every other show on television, especially the dramas that you'll find on like AMC or HBO, Raw is just the worst show on television when you look at it like that. So why would you want people to look at your show that way? Just look at it as a wrestling show. That way, it's not the worst show on television. But I can't compare Raw to another show, another hour-long show. The Walking Dead's coming back in a month. There is no comparison between The Walking Dead and Monday Night Raw in terms of the quality of its television show. I mean, there is no comparison. It's night and day between the two. So don't do that. This season premiere nonsense. They kept mentioning it as though it's supposed to impress us. Like, who gives a shit? Not one person watching this show gave a shit that it was the season premiere. All they did was get pissed off by the time they mentioned it for the eighth time. Raw opened up with a steel cage match between Chris Jericho and Bray Wyatt. Can't hate on this. It's nice to open with a match for a change instead of an authority promo in the ring. And as it goes, the match I thought was pretty good. Chris Jericho had the big highlight spot, big dive off the top of the cage onto Bray Wyatt. That will go down, I'm sure, in the highlight reel. No pun intended, the highlight reel for Monday Night Raw. Not too often you see a guy like Jericho at his age, one of the top stars like that, doing a dive. I never saw Stone Cold or The Rock do a dive off the top of the cage, probably because they were smart. They knew they didn't have to. So kudos to Jericho for that. They were fighting by the door at the end of the match, and Jericho had feigned a knee injury coming off the top of the cage. He was selling the knee, and so when they were fighting by the door, Bray started pounding on the knee, which just had Jericho in intense pain, and Bray got out via the door. So one of those rare occasions when the steel cage match ends by escaping through the door. And Bray Wyatt gets the win. He wins the rubber match in this feud. He now has two wins to Chris Jericho's one. That officially ends the Bray Wyatt-Chris Jericho feud. They have now, they've both now moved on. Bray Wyatt now is a man without a program. He's got nothing going on. In fact, he doesn't even have a match on the pay-per-view unless they add one last minute this Monday night. Chris Jericho, on the other hand, he does have a match. We'll talk about that a little bit later on. But I thought as far as opening with an actual match for a change, it was refreshing. I thought the match itself was good. It was better than the Cena-Wyatt cage match back at Extreme Rules. I can definitely say that. We had a segment of the ring with Dolph Ziggler getting some rare mic time. Intercontinental Champion in the ring, talking about the recent phone hacking scandal. And he put photos of The Miz up on the Titantron. Now, who took these photos was never revealed. You know, he had Damian Mizdow, his stunt double, with him. Although Sandow was in one of the photos, so they never bothered telling us who took the pictures. I guess Maurice, we're supposed to think Maurice maybe took the pictures. I don't know. Although they never mentioned that Maurice and Miz were married. But that's the only thing I could come up with. They never bothered explaining that. There is nothing more unfunny or uncool than the announcers laughing at comedy that isn't funny. This was one of those segments where Michael Cole is laughing. He's snorting. Every time he does that snort, I want to take a fork and I want to shove it up his nostrils and just rip his nose off. It's the most annoying freaking thing in the world. But they're cackling and they're laughing as though this whole thing is funny. This segment was just brutal. This segment was not funny at all. It was nice to see them give Ziggler some in-ring promo time, but it was a bust. And I don't even know if Dolph, how can you blame Dolph? You know, it was the comedy. How many times have we seen this where they put pictures up on the Titantron that are supposed to be funny? On occasion in the past, it has been. I think one of the funniest ones I ever saw was Chris Jericho. This was back on SmackDown in like 01. And he was feuding with Benoit at the time. And he went to that little Eggtron, you know, that little oval-shaped Tron that SmackDown used to have back in the day. And he put pictures of Benoit up. It was like a Dr. Seuss rhyme. So he had Benoit on a boat, Benoit with a goat. It was actually really, really funny. One of the rare times that they've done these stupid, you know, photo collages, these Photoshop mock-ups, and it was funny. This was not funny. This was dumb. I thought this segment just completely failed on every level. Paige and AJ against Natalya and Rosa Mendez, who spent most of the match in the ring, by the way, for her team. So Natalya spent most of her time on the apron. Rosa Mendez spent most of her time inside. Whoever made that call is clearly a masochist. Diva Stopwatch had this at 2 minutes 35 seconds, so these matches just get shorter and shorter each week. Although, I guess given the participants, they should be kept short. The announcers made a comment, I think it was Michael Cole maybe at one point, about Rosa, and this is the word he used, reintegrating into WWE. Reintegrating. She's been with the company for 8 years. What the hell does that even mean? Reintegrate. I mean, what is she, the Predator? I mean, Mark Henry's the Predator. Maybe she's the Thing. The Thing can morph into whatever it wants. Maybe that's what they were getting at here. I wish she can morph into a good wrestler. Best part about this was AJ blind tags herself into the match and very calmly walks over to Rosa and applies the Black Widow for the submission. Now, normally, when AJ applies the move, she does it coming off the ropes. There's an action sequence. She gets all flipped around, and she flips right into her move. It looks really cool. She just spins right into it. But like I tweeted when it happened, as soon as it happened, I said she made absolutely sure that Rosa could not possibly fuck this up. It was hilarious. She just calmly walks over and puts it on. There's no margin for error. Because if they would have tried it the other way, I guarantee you that it would have been completely messed up. Backstage, Randy Orton attacked Chris Jericho in the trainer's room and said it was the season premiere. One of those times that just made me go, who gives a fuck? I mean, do moves hurt more during the season premiere? Does it sting more? I don't know. John Cena and Paul Heyman had a dueling promo segment that was one of the better ones you'll ever see. He was out there playing mind games with John Cena, trying to get him to turn heel. He talked about how after years of hearing Cena sucks over and over again, deep down, it has to bother him on some level. He just has to be dying to tell the fans to shut up. And Cena teased it. Of course, then he ended up telling Paul Heyman to shut up instead. And then he cut a really, really good promo, you know, by Cena's standards, just in terms of the passion and everything else. He did this promo about how he'll never turn against the fans because he is who he is, and he's not going to change for anybody. And we've heard this promo from him a million times before, just never as passionately as we did here. So from that aspect, I really liked this. I thought the work here was really good. But the negative part to all this is, how many times do we need to hear this? You know, Cena talked about meeting Make-A-Wish kids and injured soldiers who give him their Purple Heart. He got all emotional talking about it. His delivery was as good as I've seen from him, so for that reason, I thought it was effective in what they were trying to do. But they have to stop. They just have to stop already. I mean, it's the same thing every other feud with this guy. And he told Paul Heyman he wants his client Brock Lesnar to come to Raw next week for a fight, otherwise he would fight Heyman instead. And later on, we learned that Brock will be on Raw this week. It is the go-home show, so I would certainly hope he would be there for that. But the other thing I have to say about this promo, besides the repetitiveness of John Cena coming out and giving the same speech over and over again, can we finally put the question of, will John Cena turn heel, to rest once and for all? Can we put this shit to bed, please? Okay, it wouldn't even make sense anymore. Think about what the guy is saying every time he cuts one of these promos. Think about the words that he's using. And ask yourself, would it even make sense for John Cena to turn heel at this point? The answer is no. It wouldn't. So just stop. Just stop asking. Stop hoping. It's not happening. Cena took an indirect swipe at The Undertaker at one point during this whole thing. He talked about how Brock beat him up at WrestleMania, and nobody has seen or heard from The Undertaker in 6 months. And meanwhile, Brock killed Cena at SummerSlam, and here he is, back and ready for round two. And I know it wasn't designed that way. It wasn't designed to, you know, be an insult to The Undertaker, but when I heard that line, I just thought he basically called Undertaker a pussy. That's essentially what he did. He pointed out the fact that The Undertaker is a pussy because Brock Lesnar beat him up not even nearly as bad as Brock beat Cena up at SummerSlam, and that guy hasn't been heard from in 6 months. Cena took an ass-whipping of a lifetime, and 2 weeks later, he was back and ready for more. It'd be great if it was like a subtle tease for a WrestleMania match between Taker and Cena. I pitched Cena for years on this podcast as the only WrestleMania opponent left for The Undertaker that made a lick of sense. This was before the streak got broken. You could still do the match, I guess, if they really wanted to, but it wouldn't be the same. The idea would have been that Undertaker has this streak that shouldn't be broken, that probably will never be broken, and maybe in his last match, he faces John Cena, who's been the face of the company now for over a decade, and Cena beats everybody, and people would just lose their shit if they thought that the streak would be sacrificed to John Cena, of all people. And it would have made, I think, for a real interesting fan response during the match. Now that the streak is broken, it wouldn't, you know, it really wouldn't work the same way. You could still do it, but it really wouldn't work. But the thing is, if Undertaker does wrestle one more match, they almost have to do the Sting match at this point. Sting's coming in, he's wrestling, I don't know against who, but he's definitely wrestling. And if Undertaker is well enough to wrestle on the card, at this point, especially all the times that Sting's called him out and said, I want to face him, if he retires, I guess I'll face maybe Triple H or John Cena, but if Taker goes, it's got to be against Sting at this point. And so I don't really know that we're ever going to get that Undertaker-John Cena WrestleMania match. So I don't think this was the setup for anything, and maybe they didn't realize it when they scripted this out, but that's how I read it. I read it as John Cena indirectly making Undertaker out to look like a pussy. Seth Rollins beat Sheamus, who badly botched the curb stomp from Rollins at the end of the match. He basically headbutted the mat and knocked himself out, and Rollins got the pin. Credit to JBL for having enough foresight to cover for it. He was talking about, oh, Rollins didn't get all of it. Yeah, I'll say. Although it wasn't on Rollins. It actually wasn't his fault at all. It was all on Sheamus. Cesaro had come down during the match. He grabbed the U.S. belt. He was, taunting Sheamus with it, and then they had a tug of war at one point for the belt. And after the match, Cesaro hit a neutralizer on Sheamus. He mocked his his fella pose, which was amusing. And keep in mind, Sheamus is the United States champion. Seth Rollins pinned him in the middle of the ring. He should be the number one contender for the title right now. Unlike the Divas, who apparently have to beat the champion three times in a row in non-title matches before getting a title shot. The point is, will Rollins now get a U.S. championship match? Of course not. Of course not, because they're not important enough. These titles are not important enough. That's what we're supposed to think. When you beat a champion, they should make a bigger deal about it. But I sound like a broken record on this, so what's the point anymore? Then came the best part of the show. We got a hype video for NXT TakeOver and a mention of the debut of Kenta, who is no longer Kenta. We'll get to that later. And then, in what was a major surprise, we were told that up next, the four participants in the Fatal 4-Way at TakeOver would be in tag team action. And that put a big fat smile on my face, as you can imagine. We had Adrian Neville and Sami Zayn making their Raw debut, beating Tyler Breeze and Tyson Kidd. Now, here's the thing. They were in Baltimore this week. And I would say that overall, from start to finish, this was not one of the better crowds. Baltimore was kind of dead for most of the show. And they were very much dead for most of this match. Now, they gave these guys about 2.5 minutes. It wasn't a long match. They didn't even give them entrances, which I didn't think they would. They had the jobber entrances. But the crowd did get into it as the match went on, and when Adrian Neville got the hot tag from Sami Zayn and he started going nuts and he was going a million miles an hour, that's when the fans really got into it. And I think what really tipped the scales there was he did his standing shooting star press, which was cool, but it was when Neville did the three or four consecutive backflips from one end of the ring to the other, that's when people really took notice of this guy. They were like, wow, this guy's pretty incredible. And then he capped it all off with the Red Arrow. And I just said on the podcast last week, before these guys even showed up on Raw, I said to the people who don't even bother watching NXT, you need to, because the Red Arrow is the most spectacular finisher in all of WWE. Main roster, NXT, male, female, doesn't matter. It's the best, most spectacular-looking finisher in the entire company. And now the entire world knows that. And I thought it was great when he pulled the move off. I was watching people's reactions in the front row. There was one woman who just, like, her jaw dropped, and she looked over at the person next to her like, holy shit. Like, yeah, that's pretty much my reaction even to this day every time I see that move. I don't know how he does it. He's a special performer. So he really got a nice response from the crowd when he started getting going there. And by the end, the crowd was into it. I thought it was a fine showcase for these four guys. I was so happy for them when this match was over. They had big smiles on their faces, you could tell. Like, they were really happy to be there. And I said to myself, self, you need to turn the show off right now, because it is not going to get any better. In fact, with what was coming up next, I knew it was only going to get worse. And I said, turn the show off, but I didn't. And I should have taken my own advice. By the way, just to go back to the NXT stuff before we move on here, I did a column. My new column for PW Mania this week was all about the NXT stuff, the stuff we saw on Raw Monday night. And that was one of the things that WWE got right. That was probably the biggest thing they got right during that show last Monday, was featuring the NXT performers, using that as a way to promote TakeOver, which in turn is a way to promote new network subscriptions. Hey, take a look at these four guys, including Adrian Neville. You want to see some more spectacular shit like that, pay your $9.99 and watch TakeOver, and you'll be blown away on Thursday. I thought that was the best advertising you could possibly do. And that was kind of the point of the whole column I did. That match, that 2.5 minute, almost throwaway match, was the most effective ad I've ever seen for the network. I mean, you tell me, was that not more effective as an ad for the network than screaming $9.99 over and over and over again for 3 hours? I mean, it was the best possible way you could advertise that show. It was the best possible way you could advertise that network. You don't have to scream and holler and yell at people and tell bad comedy and just generally make them fucking sick with all these $9.99 mentions. It's like they spend more time telling you how much the fucking network is, but not what you can actually get on the network. So they say $9.99 without actually telling you, hey, here's what you're going to get, besides the pay-per-views. Why should I care? Give me a reason why I should pay my $9.99, besides the pay-per-views. And I thought this was the most effective way yet that they did that. And I want to see them do more of that. I don't want to see them take an entire hour of Raw and dedicate it to NXT. People have emailed me asking that before, and I always shoot that down. I don't think that's a good idea at all. I'm not saying that. What I'm saying is, especially after what we saw on Monday, it would be nice for them to feature a little bit more NXT influence on the shows. And from what I read, there may be more NXT guys on the show this week. I don't know if they're flying them in just to do dark matches or if they'll actually be on TV. We'll see on Monday. But I think they're flying in Neville. They're flying in Zayn, Breeze. They're going to be there. Very curious to see what role, if any, they have for them on the show. But I thought even the announcers, Michael Cole, Jerry Lawler, and JBL. JBL and Cole in particular, I thought they were fine. They actually sounded like pro wrestling announcers for the first time in forever. They weren't making fun of anybody. They weren't snorting. They weren't cracking jokes. They weren't talking about the fucking app. They weren't talking about $9.99. They were talking about the action in the ring. They were putting over all the guys. JBL put over Adrian Neville. They talked about Kenta. Why can't these guys do this more often? Why can't Vince McMahon just lay out, lay back, let these guys do what they're there to do, promote the next big event coming up, and call the action? You know, it doesn't sound very complicated to me. They had the Ascension on Main Event. They beat the Matadors. So again, another way to promote the TakeOver special. I was very happy to see them actually doing what they should have been doing to promote the special and get as many people as possible to watch it. And they had the Ascension beat the Matadors, and you know, thankfully they didn't lose to them, because that would have looked pretty bad. So I just loved in general what they did on the main shows this week to promote the NXT show. I thought it was great. And from the best segment on the show, we went to the worst segment on the show, the Bella Twins intervention with Jerry Springer. It was every bit as awful as I thought it would be. It was not funny. It was not entertaining. They talked about Brie apologizing to Nikki on Twitter. Nikki came out. The two of them reluctantly shook hands. Don't even ask me about that. And Nikki said that she accepted Brie's apology, and Jerry Springer then aired a whole bunch of clips from Total Divas, which is how they should be promoting that show, only without Jerry Springer. Without the Jerry Springer garbage. Just take 3 minutes of airtime and show clips from your crappy reality show, and just leave well enough alone. And by the way, after watching these clips from Total Divas, because I hadn't seen this before, how could anybody root for Brie Bella? You know, who's the face and who's the heel in this feud? I tweeted that out to you guys during the show on Monday night. Nobody really gave me a straight answer. I said, who's the face and who is the heel? And everyone's like, I don't know. I'm like, that's great. That's really great. You know, so when they came back, Nikki talked about what a mean, negative person Brie is, and how Brie was probably the reason their father left them when they were younger. And that led to pre-taped videos from their mother and their father asking them to put their differences aside to end this. This was just so bad. And to top it all off, Springer then introduced the Bella brother, JJ, to the live audience. And this segment felt like it would never fucking end at this point. He comes into the ring. He tells Nikki to stop being the victim. Bad acting is clearly a hereditary trait in this family. This guy looks like a little douchebag, too. I don't watch the show. I mean, is he on the show, by the way? Is this the first time anybody is hearing of this Bella brother? I don't know how often the family is featured on the reality show, but, you know. Is he a douchebag on the show? I bet he is. I bet he is. He looked like one here. Sisters got into the obligatory Jerry Springer pull-apart brawl. They took poor Jerry down with them in the process. Stephanie McMahon was out there, and she got involved. She ended up rolling around on the mat, pretending like she was actually trying to break the whole thing up. Comically flopping around the ring, Stephanie McMahon was. This was Shawn Michaels at SummerSlam 05 against Hulk Hogan level of selling here from Stephanie McMahon. And they tried to sell this like Springer actually injured his ankle. He didn't get hurt. I'm amazed at how many people actually bought into that and thought that he got hurt. Hey, it happens, right? Poor Jerry Springer was an innocent bystander caught in the crossfire. Stephanie was doing her best to hold back her laughter out there. Who in their right mind would honestly think that Jerry Springer got hurt during this segment? The only one hurt when this was over was all of us for having watched it. This was garbage. That's what I'm calling these Total Diva segments from now on. Total garbage. Gold and Stardust beat Los Matadores, who literally look like a couple of dickheads out there with their pink bandanas wrapped around their heads. Usos attacked the Dust Brothers on the ramp after the match to add more fuel to the fire for their match at Night of Champions. We got a classy tribute video to the late Joan Rivers, who made a cameo at WrestleMania 2. She had Hulk Hogan on her old talk show a few times back in the day. Gave wrestling some publicity when perhaps a lot of others would not give wrestlers the time of day. She did. And it's sad that she gets one of these videos and a lot of wrestlers don't. You know, a lot of you pointed out Big Daddy V, for example, who actually had a pretty long career in WWE when you add up all of his runs together. He seemed to be well-liked, and he didn't get the same kind of treatment. It's not right, but such is life. Adam Rose beat Titus O'Neil again. Titus is so much better than this. It's just sad what they're doing with him. Heath Slater he's great in the comedy role, especially now that Santino is off the show. But why Titus? I don't understand that. And don't tell me it's because he's too old either, or I'll punch you in the brain. The Bunny super kicked Slater on the outside, then he delivered a frog splash to Titus after the match. The Bunny has got white hands, okay? We know that, as far as his identity. We know the Bunny is a white dude because he's got white hands. Maybe they can pluck somebody from NXT, and I've given this some thought. They can reveal him as, like, Playboy Bunny Rose. How's that for a name? Yeah, a little Playboy Bunny wordplay right there. Playboy Bunny Rose, right? Come on, it makes sense. He's with Adam Rose. He's one of the Rose Buds, so the name makes sense. Roman Reigns and Randy Orton was the main event. Probably Roman Reigns' longest singles match to date. I think it went about 20 minutes. I think it was longer than their SummerSlam match. Not as good as that one, I didn't think, but still a good match. Crowd was dead for a good part of it. They like I said earlier, they were like that for much of the show, really. I have to say, though, this really pissed me off. And it happens every week, but it really hit me in this match. The constant ad breaks during matches on this show is absolutely ridiculous. It is just absolutely ridiculous, especially during your main event. I mean, you can structure the show in such a way where you don't have to break away during your main event match. It just means you're going to take more ad breaks at other parts during the show, which will be annoying, but you can do that if you want to. That's the one thing I will give to Vince Russo. As much of an asshat as that guy is, you never saw that during the Attitude Era when it came to big matches. You did not have multiple cutaways. It totally kills the flow of the match. Just kills it dead. I just don't know why they do that, especially during your main event. Don't fucking cut away for a commercial during your main event. It's so dumb. And if you could do that 15 years ago, there's no reason why you can't do that now. Orton eventually called out the Authority for the assist, and down came Kane and Seth Rollins to attack Reigns for the DQ. They lowered the steel cage from earlier in the night, and in doing so, Seth Rollins was nearly impaled by one of the spikes that's used to lock the cage in place, so that was kind of scary. Reigns made a comeback. He was able to keep Rollins and Kane out of the ring as the cage came down, so that left Reigns and Orton alone on the inside. Seth Rollins climbed to the top of the cage. He dove off onto Roman Reigns, so the second cage dive on this show. Kane entered the cage. All three proceeded to beat down Reigns. No Dean Ambrose for the save. He's still on the loose, according to WWE.com, which still has never been acknowledged on TV. Based on television, I guess we're supposed to think that the man is dead. Rollins dealt the final blow with the curb stomp on a steel chair, and the Authority stood over Roman's dead body as they went off the air. So, a strong angle to close the show sets up Roman Reigns against Seth Rollins for Night of Champions. That match is now official. Chris Jericho and Randy Orton has also officially been signed. And like I said before, Bray Wyatt is the odd man out on the show. He may have won the feud with Jericho, but he may not be getting a pay-per-view payday unless they throw him on there at the last minute this week. So even though he got a win over Jericho, who really won in the end? I guess you can ask, because Jericho's got a pay-per-view match and he doesn't. So I thought Raw was an improvement over the last 2 weeks. I mean, it would have been extremely difficult for them not to have a better show than that shit they've shoveled down our throats the last 2 weeks. It's hardly a glowing compliment. This still was not overall what I would say a really good show. There were some good parts to it, but overall, it still felt mostly just like a show that's just there. There was nothing really exciting that happened. We had some good action. The Bella stuff just, it drags it down so much. It really does. I mean, you could take a good show and make it just god-awful just with that one segment every single week. And it's not even just that, but the time that they dedicate to it. It's not like a one-and-done type of thing. You know, a few weeks ago, the throwing up Bella segments, we had them strategically placed throughout the entire show. And then we had an in-ring segment, as though that other crap wasn't enough. And then this week, the Springer stuff just went on and on and on. And it really does. It affects your enjoyment of the show. I mean, it really takes you out of it. But the cage match I thought was good. The NXT stuff I loved. So for me, that was enough to make the show a hell of a lot better than it was the week before. And Raw this Monday night has a tag match already signed. It's going to be Paige and Nikki Bella against AJ Lee and Brie Bella. And Brock Lesnar will be back to confront John Cena before their big rematch at Night of Champions. So that is what we have to look forward to on the Go Home Show this coming Monday night. NXT TakeOver 2 aired on Thursday night live on the WWE Network. It was their third special, their third live special this year. I think they're doing them quarterly, so we probably have another one coming up in December. And I loved it. I thought it was great. It was so much fun. You know, these shows in some ways remind me of those ECW one-night stand shows that WWE did in 05 and 06, where it was a more intimate setting. The fans were just generally more passionate than they would be on a Monday night. The action was great. The announcing was fine. The announcing didn't hinder what you were seeing on the screen. It was just a fun 2 hours to sit there and watch pro wrestling. And that's what TakeOver was. Now, if I have to rank this one against the other two specials, TakeOver 1 and the Arrival special, if I had to rank them, I'd probably put the first TakeOver at number 1 and Arrival at number 2. This one would probably be last on the list, but by no means does that mean that this was a bad show. That just goes to show you that NXT this year is kicking all kinds of ass. NXT, in my opinion, is in a lot of ways outshining what we're seeing on the main product. And it shouldn't be that way, but it is. And Triple H had a conference call on Wednesday to promote TakeOver, and he said it best where he doesn't even really look at NXT so much as developmental anymore. I mean, it is. And a lot of these guys are trying out new moves. They're trying out new characters. Some guys will have one character. I mean, look at Adam Rose going from Leo Kruger to Adam Rose. And they'll just switch to something completely different because they're trying to find themselves. They're trying to find something that works. They're trying to find their voice. And they're learning. In some cases, you know, for every Devitt and Kenta who they bring in, there's somebody else who isn't really very good. And they have to, you know, do the drills and work with the other talent and get better, and it's fun to watch their progression. You know, when I started first watching NXT in June of last year, there were a lot of guys on the show I wasn't familiar with hardly anybody, really. And you see people from where they were then to where they are now and how much they've improved, and it's really cool. So while that is going on, Triple H said he looks at it more as its own brand now. They've created a second brand is what they've done. If WWE is one distinctive brand, NXT, under their banner, is a completely different brand. And you can't tell me that any of the guys that you saw on that show, except maybe Mojo Rawley, we'll put him on the side, but most people that you saw on that show on Thursday could be on the main roster tomorrow and people wouldn't bat an eyelash. You know, most of these guys are ready right now to go to the main roster. You look at Adrian Neville, you look at Sami Zayn, you look at Tyler Breeze, Charlotte. I mean, how long has she been doing this for? Less than a year. Not even a year, I don't think. Maybe it's been a year. It feels like it's been less than a year. But she hasn't been doing this very long. She could be on the main roster tomorrow and she'd be better than all but maybe two or three people on that Divas roster right now. Enzo and Kaz, as an act, I would love to see them on Raw, wrestling for the tag team titles. But that goes to the other aspect of all this, which is, do we really want to see any of these people promoted to the main roster anymore? If NXT is a distinctive brand all on its own, then I would love to just see these guys stay there for as long as possible so we can just get as much out of them as we can. I mean, I know their goal is to make it to TV, the audience is bigger, they can make more money. I mean, I know all that. But I'm just saying, I'm so worried now every time I hear talk about somebody being promoted to the main roster. It's gotten to the point now where I don't have this feeling of great joy and happiness in my heart. I have this feeling of dread. Like, uh-oh. Fun time's over. And it shouldn't be that way. It kind of sucks. So I'm just enjoying it for how it is. I think the roster they have down there now is just phenomenal. And with the guys they have coming in, it's only going to get more fun. You saw the selfie that Triple H took. I don't know if he's a mark or a troll. I never looked at Triple H as being like an internet mark. But there he is, taking a picture with Kenta and with Steen and with Devitt. I'm going to go with troll. We'll call him Triple Troll. I thought that selfie was great. And in that photo, the best part was I see two, three guys in that picture who could be the future of this company if they're given the opportunity to go out there and do what they do best 10 years from now. Those guys could be right up there at the top of the food chain. So that's pretty cool to see. I went 3-2 in my predictions, which isn't great, although that's one of the things I like about NXT. It's not always as predictable as you would find on the main roster. I thought the Ascension would retain and Charlotte would lose, and in fact, the opposite happened. I have to say, you know, with NXT, one thing I've noticed, whether it's the way they shoot things or whatever, now they have this digital ring apron on the hard camera side. I don't know how many of you noticed that, but the ring apron on that one side was basically either a giant screen or like a wall of screens. I thought that was really cool. They innovate more on this show than they do on Raw. I wish they would try stuff like that on the show that actually gets 4 million people every single week. Because if there's any show on television right now that they're putting out that's stale as shit, it's Raw. But they seem to be doing more innovating here on this show. So we opened up with the Ascension defending their NXT Tag Team titles against the team of Sin Cara and Kalisto, who are now calling themselves the Lucha Dragons, which I actually think is a pretty cool name. I just like the fact that we're getting some real tag team names again in 2014. I want to see more of that. I want to go back to the days of LOD and Demolition and the Hart Foundation. I mean, you know, Kaz and Enzo, you could do better than that. You know, we have the Vaude Villains, okay, so that's a team name. Now we have the Lucha Dragons, the Ascension. On the main roster, though, I'm just thinking of the main roster. We have Goldust and Stardust, that's not a team name. We have the Usos, that's not a team name. We have Curtis Axel and Ryback, that's not a team name. We have Los Matadores, okay, that's a crappy name, but I guess that's one team name. Who am I missing? The Wyatts? Yeah, I guess. I want to see them do more of that, though. The Lucha Dragons is one of the cooler tag team names they've had in quite a while. So they won the tag team titles from the Ascension, 344 days, almost a year. Their reign has come to an end. I think the bigger story here is that Sin Cara finally has a belt after all this time. He is now a champion in WWE. Kalisto got the winning fall on Rick Victor. And, yeah, it was a good match. Probably one of the weaker matches on the show when you compare it to the others, but it wasn't a bad match. It was a good opener. Not as hot as I thought it would be. You know, when we saw that match a few weeks ago, it was Sin Cara and Kalisto against Sami Zayn and Adam Rose. And I felt like that match was like the coming out party for Kalisto in a lot of ways. He was pulling off some amazing moves in that match. And I just assumed that come TakeOver, it was going to be the Kalisto showcase. Like, he had one or two other big moves up his sleeve that he was going to debut, and they were going to really put the shine on him. And I didn't really get that sense. I mean, he looked good, and he got the winning fall, but he didn't really do anything in this match that we haven't seen him do before. But it was good. CJ Parker and Baron Corbin. This was one of the best things on the entire show. It was a last-minute addition. We had been told that CJ Parker would be wrestling a mystery opponent, but did not know who it was. And it turned out to be Baron Corbin in what they were calling his debut. In fact, it was not his debut. He has appeared many times before on NXT. More like a re-debut. Big guy, good look, used to play for the Cardinals in the NFL. Aman in our Facebook group, and this is what makes it even better. He posted a video of CJ Parker. CJ Parker himself had a re-debut back in February when he started doing the hippie gimmick. And his opponent in that match, when CJ Parker made his re-debut, Baron Corbin. So now we've come full circle. So he's just standing there. He got the jobber entrance. He's already in the ring. He's just standing there and he's staring a hole at CJ Parker. And the match starts, and the first thing he does is they lock up. He throws Parker down to the mat, and CJ comes right back at him, and Corbin catches him with a shot to the face. It made like a gunshot sound. It sounded awesome. And, you know, the fans are like, holy shit. So that was the first sign of, okay, this guy means business. And then, you know, he doesn't get paid by the hour. He went right for the finish. His finish, it does look similar to Sister Abigail. A lot of people wrote into me saying, oh, it's kind of like Bray Wyatt's move. Kind of. It is this swinging reverse STO, which is exactly what the move is. I can't even describe it. You just have to see it. It looked very impressive. It was an awesome finish. And he pinned him. And that was it. And just like that, Corbin left. And he made a statement on the show. And I think that if they push him as this big monster who wrestles quick matches, because I don't know how good he really is. I don't know if he can go in there and have like a solid 10-minute match. But they got something with this guy, because you only have one chance to make a really good first impression. And even though this technically was not his debut, you got to look at it as his re-debut. You got to look at it as there probably were many new eyeballs on him, maybe some new network subscribers who wouldn't know Baron Corbin from a fucking hole in the wall. It was their first time seeing this guy. And even the appearances that he made before, he was never involved in a storyline or a feud. He never did anything meaningful. He was like kind of like an enhancement guy on NXT in a lot of ways. So people may not remember him, because he had a very forgettable run. So this was his chance to start fresh. He made a great first impression, and I think that they really could have something with this guy. It was awesome. And the fact that he laid out CJ Parker, of all people, just made me an instant fan. We had hair versus hair. Enzo Amore and Sylvester Lefort. Probably the worst match on the entire show. It wasn't dreadfully bad or anything like that, but it wasn't really all that good. It was a standard match, you know, not much happened. Even the crowd really wasn't that much into it until the finish, really. They were totally into Kaz and Enzo. Just once the match started, it was kind of dull. You know, even the Bull Mojo match, which came a little bit later on, it was quick. But that's exactly what that match had to be. They didn't overstay their welcome. They went out there, they beat the crap out of each other, and it was over in like a minute. So I can't even say that was the worst match on the show. This match, I would put at the very bottom, but it wasn't terrible or anything like that. Enzo got the win, to no one's surprise, which meant that by the stipulation, Lefort had to have his head shaved. And they did not honor that stipulation. Sylvester Lefort escaped. Marcus Louis came out, a big brawl erupted, and in this fracas, he escaped. He ran away. I guess we're supposed to think like most Frenchmen do, they run away. And that was kind of dumb, you know, that they didn't honor the stipulation. But we did get Marcus Louis' head shaved a little bit later on in the show. What they did was he actually had that hair cream poured on his head that we had seen in that segment with Carmella that supposedly makes your hair fall out. And it was great, too, because when Kaz and Enzo were on stage, I think it was Kaz who shouted at Enzo. He's like, Enzo, get the bucket! And everyone popped. I thought that was great. So yeah, they poured it on his head, and Louis went backstage, and I'm sure they then shaved his head very quickly and put a towel on his head, so when we saw him later on, his head only had like a patch or two of hair still on it. He looked like a complete freak. And who knows, maybe Lefort will end up getting his head shaved on a show later on in the future, but they didn't shave it on this show, so that was kind of a disappointment. We had then the introduction of Kenta. Ric Flair, I think, was supposed to be there to do this, but he pulled out for some unknown reason, so instead it was William Regal, the general manager, which actually made more sense than having Ric Flair there to do this. So Regal comes out, he puts over Kenta big. They had a video for Kenta, too. They put this guy over like $1 million on this show. And out comes Kenta, who did his best to speak English, and he is learning. It is a work in progress. He's certainly making more of an effort than the original Sin Cara did to learn English. And he spoke in Japanese as well, which kind of lost the crowd a little bit. They didn't crap on him too much, but you could tell they you know, he kind of lost them there for a little bit. Probably what he should have done is just in English say, if you'll give me a moment, I'd like to address the Japanese people watching live, and then go into it, and maybe people would have understood. Because they were airing this show. This is how big of a deal him being on NXT was. NXT aired live in Japan because this guy was making his debut. So whatever time it was over in Japan, they were watching. They wanted to hear from this guy. So he addressed them in Japanese, and then he started speaking, you know, the broken English. He did pretty good. You know, I could understand what he was saying, but he didn't say much because he's still learning. But the big news here is that he said, being here at NXT, it's a dream come true, and I know I have to start over. And part of starting over is getting a new name, I guess, because he said from now on, he will go by the name of Hideo Itami. And they put the name up on the screen, and people in the building didn't know how to react. They're kind of like, oh. I think it was this feeling of just disappointment, because we were kind of hopeful he would use the name Kenta, which is how he's known around the world. And to be perfectly honest with you, I do think Kenta is just way more marketable. I just hear the word Kenta, and I just think, okay, you can chant that, you know, it's an easy thing to chant, and it's pretty marketable. So yeah, it's kind of cool that they would let him use it. But not the case. He had to change his name. Everyone is just pitching a freak fit. They can't believe this. They already buried him. The burial begins. Kent is dead before he even has a chance to succeed on NXT. Let me talk about this for a little bit here. First of all, he said that he chose the name because he wanted to pay homage to his mentor. Now, he didn't say who his mentor was. I don't know anybody who worked in NOAH or that he worked with named Hideo, who was like a big legend in Japan. You know, some people thinking he took the name Hideo after the baseball player Hideo Nomo, which I think is, maybe he did, but I think that's just a dumb generalization for people to make. Like, who's the first person I could think of with the name Hideo? Well, it was a baseball player, so that must be the guy, as though there's nobody else in Japan named Hideo. That's just a stupid generalization to make. I'm not even sure that any of that is true. That may just be the story that he came up with. Oh, I want to pay respect to my mentor. There may not be a mentor. Or his mentor may be Kobashi or Misawa. But WWE can't take the Kobashi or the Misawa name and market it, so I don't think they would have allowed him to take that name. It sounds like he at least had input into what the name would be. Now, like I said before, I do think Kenta is more marketable. John Cena uses his real name. And it's not like WWE isn't making millions of dollars off that guy. But for every John Cena, there's a CM Punk who kept ownership of his name. And wouldn't you know, his lawyer sends a letter to WWE, and they've since removed all of his merchandise from their website. First thing they did was they marked it down. So there were CM Punk DVDs for like $3 on WWE shop until they all got snapped up. And now there's nothing. You do a search for CM Punk, nothing comes up. All of his merchandise has either been sold, or it's been burned, or whatever they're doing with it, it's gone. It's no longer available. There's a reason they want ownership of people's names. The situation with Punk is not going to make things any better when it comes to that. Yet a few select morons on the show still chant the guy's name. They chant CM Punk. See, I think during the main event they were chanting CM Punk. You know, and I give the people in Full Sail, the crowd at Full Sail, I give them shit sometimes because they deserve it. But every now and then, the Full Sail crowd will make me proud. And that was one of those moments. Some people started chanting Punk's name, and they were quickly drowned out by boos. I'm surprised they didn't get their asses kicked. That made me so happy to see that chant died a death instantly because people would not allow it. They would not stand for it. So they just booed it. But I would tell people, just stop freaking out over the name. It's not a big deal. He'll be fine. And it really, as far as the name goes, it's not that bad. Once he makes it to the main roster, you know, Vince has this fetish for one-word names. I'm sure it'll be shortened to Itami. And Itami in Japanese, from what I've read, means pain. That sounds pretty badass to me. I read that on Urban Dictionary. It's where I get all my knowledge from. That's how I learned what a Cleveland Steamer was, after John Cena mentioned that in one of his raps on The Rock. And after looking it up, I wish I had never done so. John Cena's a sick man. As far as his debut went, I thought they did as good a job as you could have asked for. I mean, they had the Ascension come out, and you can almost kind of tell. It's like the old school. Like, if you were in a territory, and you were leaving that territory, you would do the, you know, quote, do the honors on the way out, and you would lose. Because it didn't matter. You were going to go away, and back then you can wrestle somewhere else, and nobody would know that you got jobbed out cross-country in some other place because you didn't have the internet, and just people didn't know. This was kind of like that because the Ascension lost the tag titles. They came back out here. They were showed up by Kent. They got their asses kicked. So you could kind of tell they're probably getting called up soon because it's almost like they're on their way out of the territory, and so now they're doing the honors. So they came out here to confront Kenta. They actually tossed him out of the ring. And I'm sure there were a lot of people who saw that and went, oh, here we go. Already they're making Kenta look like a jabroni. But no, Kenta got right back up on the apron. He took off his jacket. He was going into Kenta mode. And he took both guys on head-on. He kicked the crap out of them, got them out of the ring, went outside, grabbed the steel chair, brought it in, opened the chair, sat down in the chair, and motioned for them to come back in the ring and get more. Come get your asses kicked again, he said. And the Ascension backed off. So he handled both guys, Connor and Victor, all by himself and looked like a badass in doing so. I don't see how anybody could complain about this debut. This was one of the strongest debuts I've ever seen for a guy in WWE. Not just NXT. In WWE, period. I thought they handled this great. And I am cautiously optimistic for the future of Kenta. He has to keep learning the language. He can't come up to the main roster barely knowing English and expect that they're going to do much with him because they rely so much on you having promo ability. But if he keeps up at that and he gets better and he gets better, and we already know he can go, he can wrestle. I mean, that's never been the issue. I like what his future looks like. I'm cautiously optimistic right now. But I thought the way they handled this was just excellent. We had Bull Dempsey and Mojo Rawley, a match that went all of a minute, maybe 90 seconds. Bull beat the crap out of him. He even busted Mojo up, I think, by the eye. He split him open. And Bull won with a headbutt off the top rope, Bam Bam Bigelow style, which is awesome. Not just because it's a cool move, but because that hopefully means he dumped that horrific body slam finish that he had. His finish was basically a body slam. That is not a good finish. And I was hoping he would change it, and so I'm hoping that that's the change they made. Because even a simple headbutt off the top rope is a lot better than a body slam. So Bull got the win. I don't know what's up with Mojo. I don't know if they're about to cut the guy or what. But boy, they went from pushing him as something special and him steamrolling over everybody to him losing every match he's in. He barely got any offense in here at all. He got beat in a minute. I don't know what his future holds. But it looks like they're building Bull maybe to be a championship contender for Adrian Neville down the line. You know, I could actually see them building Bull up enough where he could challenge Neville for the belt maybe halfway between now and the next special. So if they do another live special in December, I don't want to see them build to a Bull Dempsey-Adrian Neville match on that special. But it would be a challenger for Neville to kind of keep busy with in the meantime before he moves on, let's say, to Sami Zayn, hopefully. I could definitely see them going that way with Bull, as strong as they've booked him of late. We had the NXT Women's Championship on the line, Charlotte defending against Bayley, and it was another case of them giving the women time to go out there and do their thing. It wasn't the 16 minutes that they gave Paige and Emma or Charlotte and Natalya, but they still gave them 10 minutes and 40 seconds, which is a lot more than I can say for the Divas matches on Raw and SmackDown, and even the pay-per-views. Even the pay-per-view Divas matches now don't go that long. So they gave them a lot of time. There were a few hiccups in the match. It was not completely smooth. There were some a little botch here and there. Even the moonsault by Charlotte at the end, she basically landed on her feet. That didn't look too good. But I thought that those little hiccups aside, I thought it was a really good match, and I loved the story they were telling with Bayley never giving up. They had Bayley's facial expressions. I just thought this was so good. Both of them were so good. Charlotte was awesome. And Bayley was awesome in this match. And she went for her belly-to-Bayley suplex at one point, but Charlotte countered it. So we never got to see the belly-to-Bayley suplex actually executed here in this match. But after Bayley kicked out of the moonsault, Charlotte couldn't believe it. And they had this great shot. The camera picked up, as Bayley is struggling back up. She's like near death here, but she's not giving up. And Charlotte just looks at her and goes, it's almost like, fuck this shit. And she just nailed the cutter, which she's renamed. It's no longer Bow Down to the Queen. I think it's called Natural Selection, I think is the name they've given it. She nailed her with the cutter and got the pin. And I have to say, I haven't felt this way in a while. When she got the pin, I wasn't disappointed because I had predicted that Charlotte would drop the title. I was genuinely bummed out because I wanted badly to see Bayley win that championship. What made this so great wasn't just the match itself, which was really good. Although, again, I would put it at a level below the match where Charlotte won the belt. But what made this so great, you don't see this level of promotion, the video packages, for a Divas match, ever. You just don't see that. But here they had this video package that, if it didn't turn you into a Bayley fan, you have no soul. That's all I'm going to say. She's crying in the video, she's tearing up and getting all emotional about what it would mean for her to win the championship and how special that moment would be for her. And Charlotte being a great heel, you know, they immediately cut to her and she's just insulting Bayley. And, you know, you just wanted so badly to see this woman lose and you wanted to see Bayley win. And when she didn't, and I genuinely thought she would, she came out with new ring gear and new music and everything was just positioned just right to make you think that she's walking away with the belt. And she got beat, fair and square. There was no cheating, there was no hook in the tights, there was no distraction bullshit roll-up. She hit her move, and she pinned her 1-2-3, and that was it. And it kind of deflated the crowd. They really wanted to see Bayley win. And I was genuinely bummed out. It wasn't just, oh, somebody lost a match, the match was great, the match quality. I was like, damn, I really wanted to see this woman win. And I was truly bummed out, because I was, you know, they got me, man. I was invested in this match. I actually cared about who was going to win and who was going to lose. And that's more than I can say for almost any match. I mean, I guess I could go back to Cena-Lesnar at SummerSlam, because I wanted to see Lesnar win because it was the right thing to do. I can't say that I had this emotional connection where, oh, I hope Brock Lesnar wins. Now, Brock Lesnar, I mean, who cares, you know? It doesn't mean anything to him, but you really got the impression here that this meant something for real to Bayley, and so you can get behind her. I just thought this was great, and after the match, Sasha Banks came out. She went after Bayley. Charlotte, who had already, she was halfway up the ramp, I think WrestleMania 18, okay, when the NWO was in the ring, beating down on Hogan. Rock's already halfway down the aisleway. He sees up on the screen what's going on. He turns around, runs back to the ring to help Hogan. Well, that's what Charlotte did. She came back down to the ring. She pulled Sasha off, saved Bayley. Looked like it might be a babyface turn, although I think later, by the end of the night when they did the stuff on the post-show, it was obvious it wasn't a face turn. It was more Charlotte, A, not liking Sasha because they had their split, and B, earning a certain level of respect for Bayley. And now it looks like they're transitioning into a three-way feud for the championship involving Sasha, who's also very good. And what's not to like about this? What is not to like about the Divas in NXT right now? And then we have the main event. Fatal 4-Way for the NXT Championship. Adrian Neville defending against Tyson Kidd, Tyler Breeze, and Sami Zayn. They had video packages for each of the guys in the match all throughout the show. So again, a tremendous job they did of building this match up as something special, making you care about the guys that you should have cared for. Sami Zayn, the ultimate underdog. Everybody wanted to see Sami Zayn come out of this with the title. I had predicted Neville would win. I just felt like the announcers were railing on him too much for being dumb. Why would he ask for a match like this where he doesn't even have to be pinned to lose his title? And I felt like they were talking about it so much that he had to have been winning this match. And he did, but not before these four guys went out there and just tore the house down. Now, one of the things about the video package on Neville earlier in the show was, he came across as awfully cocky and arrogant in that promo. And it didn't necessarily make me think, okay, he's being turned heel, but it definitely made me think, okay, I wonder if that might be the direction they're going in. And I felt the same way when the show was over. So they have whatever their story is. You just watch this and you get the sense that these are people, whoever's writing the show or booking the show and whatever influence Triple H has, which he has a lot, you know, NXT is his baby. He's not the one actually writing the show. But whoever it is, they have their shit together because they have a plan in place. They know where they're going, maybe months down the road. But they know where they're going with this. And it's nice. It's nice to see these things play out over a period of time. So I'm very curious to see where Neville, you know, 3 months from now, come the next live special, is he going to be a full-blown heel? I don't know. That's part of the fun of watching these next 3 months, the evolution of the character and the story they tell with him and Zayn and whoever else may be involved. I don't necessarily see Adrian Neville as a heel. And I think that's a problem because he was the guy who shined on Raw Monday night. And one of the reasons was because he's just so much fun to watch. And his finishing move is the most spectacular in the entire company. So if he goes heel, to have a heel pulling off a move like the Red Arrow, which he's going to get cheered for, doesn't really make a lot of sense. So I'm not convinced they're turning him heel, but I almost hope they don't, and they keep it somewhat ambiguous, where, you know, it was like that with Tyson Kidd when they were doing the storyline for a while with him in Italia, and then one day he finally just, you know, snapped and he went heel. But it would be kind of cool for them to do something similar with Neville, but never actually pull the trigger and turn him. It's just him realizing that, hey, I'm better than everybody else, and, you know, look what happened at the end of the match here, you know, when he pulled the referee out. He even said it on the post-game show with Renee Young. I didn't cheat. I didn't do anything to cheat. What did I do that was wrong? Now, you could argue he kind of did, because you're not supposed to put your hands on the referee. But, yeah, he really didn't cheat. He did what anybody who wanted to keep their title would do. You do whatever you have to do to stop him from counting three, and that's all Neville really did in this match. But it was just that people wanted Zayn to win so badly that people looked at Neville as like, you motherfucker. And they, you know, some people were booing him because that's how much people were hoping to see a title change, and they were hoping to see Sami Zayn, I think, walk away with the belt. So this match was just, it was just incredible. Every single person in this match looked good, and they had their different moments. Tyson Kidd, for example, kept throwing Neville outside the ring. I didn't think Neville was ever going to get any offense in. He spent half the match laying on his back out on the floor. To the point where I was thinking, hey, is he hurt? Maybe he got hurt and they didn't tell anybody. So every time Neville would try to get back in the ring, Tyson would just knock him back off the apron to the floor. And Tyson Kidd looked like a badass for a certain period of time in this match. He was kicking all kinds of ass. Then Tyler Breeze had his time to shine, and there was this great sequence where Breeze hit the beauty shot, and I think Neville came off the ropes, and he caught Neville in midair with a drop kick, and he did something else to Sami Zayn. I mean, Tyler Breeze was going nuts, and they made you think for that one near fall, okay, he's going to win the belt, and he didn't. And what was so great about it was every single time he went for a near fall and it failed, Breeze had this epic meltdown, the likes of which we haven't seen probably since Christian. I think Christian used to be the one to do this, where, you know, the guy would kick out and he would start like smacking the canvas, and he was almost like in tears, like, what do I have to do to get the pinfall here? Just an epic meltdown, very entertaining. Sami Zayn then finally had his chance to shine. He went crazy. Adrian Neville, when he finally made his way back in the ring, he went crazy. So every single one of the guys in this match had an ample amount of time to shine and get their shit in and look good. It put all of them over. There was nobody who came out of this match looking like the weak link. I think that's the thing. There really wasn't any one person in this match when it was over like, okay, he was the weak link of the match. No, they all looked strong. Every match should be that way. So, in the end, we had Sami Zayn getting the mother of all near falls. He hit his kick in the corner. I want to say it was on Kidd. It was Kidd or Breeze. I don't remember who. And at the very last moment, Adrian Neville, who had been on the outside, pulls the referee out. And they showed, you know, an up-close shot of Sami's face. He can't believe it. His friend, what he just did to him. And they show Neville, you know, sprawled out on the barricade, kind of looking up at Sami, and it was this great moment. And Neville, in the end, hits the Red Arrow, gets the pin, retains the championship, so his reign continues. And this epically disappointed look on the face of Sami Zayn, like, he can't believe what just happened, he can't believe he lost. There are people who I see are upset that Sami lost another big match, he's such a jobber, like, just stop. You don't know what you're talking about here. To me, I look at this, and clearly what they're doing here, maybe I'm wrong, but clearly what they're doing here is they're building to an Adrian Neville versus Sami Zayn, big time, maybe babyface versus babyface, or maybe by then it'll be heel versus face, singles match at the next live special in December. It's almost like Ring of Honor in some ways, isn't it? It kind of feels that way. We've seen that before, like when he was, you know, Generico in Ring of Honor, and they built to the big final battle show in December. I remember the final battle match, I think it was with Kevin Steen. It was the big blow-off, I think, to their feud. And it's like ROH. I only make the comparison because Ring of Honor has more than just quarterly shows. but they don't have big shows like every single month. They spread them out over the like every few months or every other month, whatever it is. And NXT, I think it just works because it's like that. If you had these shows every single month, it wouldn't be as special. I wish they would do them more often. Maybe they do them every 2 months instead of every 3 or 4. But I wouldn't go beyond that because then it's going to lose the appeal that it has. And by spreading the shows out like that over the course of a year, the reason these matches, I think, are matches that we can get invested in is because they've been built up for 3, 4 months, sometimes 6 months, maybe even longer. There's something to be said for being able to take your time to build these big matches up. So I think with everything that we've already seen, the storyline now being where it's at, plus whatever they do between now and then, if that's the plan and they build to a Neville versus Zayn title match to cap off the end of the year for NXT, I mean, that's going to be unbelievably huge. And that would be the moment for Sami Zayn to get that big win and walk away as the NXT champion. And I really do. I really hope that's what the end game here is. I hope that's what they're building to. If Sami gets beat one more time, I think it's one time too many. I think it's okay that he lost here. People will still be into it if he wins the title later on, but I feel like if he gets one more shot and he fails again, that's going to be one time too many. So we'll see. We'll see where they build to, but I just thought everything about this was just great. I loved it. I loved the build-up for everything, the action, where they seem to be going. We still have, you know, Devitt and Steen in the pipeline waiting whenever they're ready to debut. Solomon Crow. I mean, there's a lot to like right now about NXT, and these specials are one of them. They really are worth the $9.99 price for the network alone. I mean, when this show is over, I felt like it doesn't matter what else they do, what else they offer us on the network this month, pay-per-views or anything like that. I've already gotten my money's worth. ProWrestlingTees.com is the new home for Sound Off shirts and apparel. Get your official Solomonster Sounds Off logo t-shirt and other assorted designs like the new Eat, Sleep, Sound Off, Repeat shirt, which sounds an awful lot like a typical week for me. And I know it is for some of you guys as well. Now you can show your support for the podcast wherever you go by buying a shirt. Hell, buy two of them. Pro Wrestling Tees accepts PayPal as payment and ships internationally all over the world. The more shirts we sell, the more designs we'll be able to offer in the future, but we can only do that with your help. Be one of the first 25 people to buy a shirt, and you'll get a shout-out right here on the Sound Off. Visit ProWrestlingTees.com/SolomonsterSoundsOff to go directly to our new store. That's ProWrestlingTees.com/SolomonsterSoundsOff. Kurt Angle was in the news this past week. He had done a radio interview and was asked what he would label himself. You know, would he label himself a TNA guy, for example, because he's been there, I think, about as long as he's been in WWE, maybe even slightly longer, something like 8 years. And Angle said no. He goes, I can't do that. You know, just like you can't label Sting a TNA guy. He'll always be a WCW guy in the eyes of many. He can't label himself a TNA guy because WWE is where he made his name. Vince McMahon made him and gave him the opportunity to become a big star, and so that's how he and other people, I guess, in his view, will look at him, not as a TNA guy, but as a WWE guy. And this comes at a time his contract, he has said before, expires on September 21st, which is coming up in about a week. Angle claims that he knows where he's going. I don't know if that means he's already signed the new deal or what the situation is, but he claims that he knows where he's going. He's going to make the announcement before his contract even comes due in TNA, which means sometime before the 21st, according to Kurt Angle, he's going to make an announcement about where he will end up. He has said before the next wrestling contract he signs will probably, at his age now, will be his last. And he definitely wants to go back to WWE. I don't think there's any doubt about that. Just listen to him do any of these interviews. But the resistance is there from the company, from Vince McMahon, maybe even Triple H. You know, supposedly he had contacted the company, contacted Triple H, got blown off, went over his head to Vince, and that didn't sit well with Triple H. So whatever the case is, if WWE wanted Kurt, they probably could have gotten him back when his last contract was up, and there was no interest there. So why that would change now, I don't know. You just have to assume that the interest level is not there from WWE. So if I had to venture a guess, I don't see him going back to WWE. Not now, anyway. Never say never. But if he has signed a new deal, and he's already, you know, hyping it up, and he's going to make the announcement, he says you know, his recovery from knee surgery is going a little slower than anticipated. So he's not going to be wrestling again until January. Whoever he signs with, he will not be physically able to go in the ring until January. And people are you know, thinking, well, the Royal Rumble's in January, so the timing would make sense for a WWE comeback. Look, if he comes back to WWE, great. I'll be shocked as all hell. But I think he'll end up back in TNA or with Global Force, Jeff Jarrett's promotion, which we still know very little about. He's made no announcements about any events, no news on a TV deal. He keeps putting these press releases out announcing partnerships with different companies all over the world. It all sounds cool. It would be nice to actually have more than that to go on. So I have no idea what the deal is with Global Force Wrestling, when they're even launching. Sometime next year, I guess. But, you know, he's got the good relationship with Jeff Jarrett. You know, there was some animosity there way back when it came out that he was going out with Angle's ex-wife. That's all been smoothed over. They worked together, and they've since become good friends. So I could see him going there, or I could see him just taking the deal that TNA offered him. Because TNA offered him a deal. He said he didn't sign it because he was hoping to go back to WWE. And if WWE won't take him, I could see him just saying, all right, well, I'll take the deal that Dixie Carter offered me. So I figure that's where he ends up. I just don't see him coming back to WWE anytime soon, maybe eventually for a Hall of Fame induction. But it's obvious if they wanted him, they would have had him already. Impact on Wednesday night opened with Sergeant Chris Melendez making his in-ring TNA debut. He is the amputee trained for free by Bubba and Devon at the Team 3D Training Academy, injured by an IED in Iraq many years ago. So he wrestled Zema Ion in the most basic match you'll ever see. I mean, there really was nothing to it. They had his debut on this show to coincide with the anniversary of the 9/11 attacks. I think in his story, maybe I'm wrong, somebody can correct me, but I think it was after the attacks on 9/11 that inspired him to enlist, and that's when he went overseas, and I think he had something like 23 days left before he was coming home, and that's when he got injured. So a sad story turned into a positive story because this guy didn't give up. You know, he survived it. He said, I want to be a pro wrestler, and he worked at it, and I give the guy all the credit in the world. You know, he's a lot tougher than I am, and he's out there doing his thing, but anybody who expects this guy to become, you know, a big top-tier wrestler in TNA, I think, is fooling themselves, because I'm watching this match independently. I'm just watching it, and I'm thinking to myself, this guy is already at a handicap in that he can't do a lot of the things that everybody else on the roster can do. You know, especially in TNA, you have all those X guys flying around all over the place doing all these dazzling moves and moves off the top rope. It was very obvious to me that this guy is every bit as limited as you would think he would be. I mean, the guy's got one leg. So, you know, he's got the prosthetic, and that allows him to move around, but the way he was moving around in there, and part of that also may be the fact that he's inexperienced. Again, this was his debut. He does not have any TNA matches under his belt. This was his first one. This was his first pro match. So the combination, I think, of you know, the physical stuff with the fact that he's still learning and doesn't necessarily know a whole lot, I hope people have, you know, tempered their expectations for this guy. I think it's a nice story. I don't know what his future really is in this company, because I just feel like he's at a severe disadvantage with what he can do inside that ring. And at the end of the day, if you can't go inside that ring, then, you know, there's a lot of other guys who deserve a spot on that roster who aren't getting it right now. And right now, it's a feel-good story. 6 months from now, is it going to be the same feel-good story? That would be my question. And it's not like we haven't seen TNA cast guys aside before, you know, who they've made promises to or who had a nice story. Jesse Neal, right, was another one, and he ended up getting cut. So a lot can happen, and who even knows 6 months from now if TNA will still be on television? I figure there will be somewhere, but you never know. But, you know, it was nice to see him out there doing his thing and living his dream. I just don't know what his future really is in TNA. We had Bobby Roode come out for a promo, and MVP Lashley and Kenny King followed. And by the way, in the match with DJ Zema, I forgot to mention, he won with a Samoan drop. So there you go. But Roode is out there with MVP Lashley and Kenny King. They end up attacking Bobby Roode. Samoa Joe, Eric Young run down for the save. Joe is just full of fire. He gets on the mic and he says, enough of this shit. In so many words, he didn't actually say that. He said, why don't you got three of you guys, we got three guys here, why don't we do this tonight? And in fact, why wait? Let's do it right now. So we had ourselves a six-man tag. Pretty good match. Bobby Roode got the win. He pinned MVP with the Roode Bomb. So Bobby Roode, who is now the number one contender for the TNA World Heavyweight title, looks strong in advance of his big title match on Wednesday night coming up against Lashley. We had the Bromans and Velvet Sky beating Nux, Crazy Steve, and Rebel from the Menagerie in what I believe was Rebel's first match. Definitely looked like her first match. If you watched her here, she'd fit right in on Total Divas. She gave Velvet a body slam that looked pretty bad. It looked comical. Velvet rolled her up and hooked the trunks to get the win, and everybody at home got up close and personal with Rebel's ass. So when I look at it like that, I can't really complain about this match. It ended on a high note. I still think this Tinder nonsense with the beautiful people and the bromans is just completely stupid. It's just one of those storylines that, I mean, wrestling is over the top and unbelievable, but this is just so unbelievable to me that I just can't buy into any of it. Kurt Angle called out EC3, who threatened to take out Kurt if he did not meet his demands, one of which is still get rid of Bully Ray, terminate him from TNA. EC3 is still crowing about Dixie going through the table. He's still very upset about that. I guess if somebody put my aunt through a table, I'd be pretty pissed off too. Angle put him in a street fight with Rhino, who came to the ring with trash cans filled with plunder. I am so sick of these hardcore matches on Impact. Every single week with one of these matches, it's beyond stale at this point. You had EC3 last week in a promo. Actually, the words he spoke in the promo could not have been truer words about how he's so sick he wants a moratorium on using the words hardcore and extreme. Amen. Amen, brother EC3. That's what I say. I'm on your side. I mean, how many weeks in a row have we seen this with Rhino and Tommy Dreamer and the Weapons? And that doesn't even count the hardcore shit with Abyss and Bram. It's like, can we please get beyond this? People ask, oh, well, you should bring back the hardcore title in WWE. Let's bring back the hardcore title. The hardcore title was fun. It was a lot of fun, especially the 24/7 stuff with Crash. That was one of the most fun things about that Attitude Era period. It would not be the same if you tried to do it now, because you're trying to do hardcore matches in a PG environment. TNA is not a PG environment, and I'm already sick of all the hardcore shit. So that's another great, glaring example of why they should not bring back the hardcore shit. Because after a couple of weeks, it overstays its welcome, and nobody cares. It gets no reaction. It's almost like they have this thing in their brain, like, we're in New York City, and so all New York City people love street fights, and they love weapons. I've lived in New York my entire life. Guess what? I like a perfectly good, normal wrestling match every now and then. I don't walk down the street when I go to work every single day, and I wake up in the morning, and the first thing I do when I get off the bus is I pull out my kendo stick, and I beat the shit out of the bus driver with the kendo stick. And then I go into my office building, and I see the doorman, and I go, hey, and I throw a trash can at his face. That's not how life is here in New York. Apparently, TNA has a completely different concept of how New York City works than the rest of us do. It's okay to give us a straight wrestling match. We don't need hardcore matches every single week. Anyway, EC3 pinned him clean with the one percenter on a steel chair. So the one good thing I will say about this, if it has to be done, at least they're continuing to put EC3 over strong. But seriously, enough of these. Jeremy Borash was in the ring with all the knockouts to announce the cover girl for next year's TNA knockouts calendar. Anybody want to take bets on whether TNA lasts longer than the duration of that calendar? Angelina Love cut him off as he was about to announce the winner, as though she already knew that she had won. So she played the Sid here to Velvet Sky's Hulk Hogan at that WrestleMania 8 press conference. Velvet was in fact the winner. Angelina was not happy about this, so they are teasing a split with the beautiful people. This brought out Havoc. Gail Kim went right after her, stemming from last week when Havoc laid her and Taryn Terrell out. But Havoc threw her into the steel guardrail. Havoc then chokeslammed Brittany, and then she took the knockouts belt and she left. We got a pre-tape with James Storm back in his log cabin in the woods, this time with Manic all tied up. I love how the announcers, by the way, when these segments end, they never seem even remotely concerned about the fact that James Storm has kidnapped somebody and is holding them hostage in some secret location. At least pretend to care about Manic. pretend to care about Sonata when this guy is tied up in a shack somewhere in the middle of nowhere? Storm wanted to know why Manic wears a mask. He went to unmask him, but told the camera guy to leave before he did so. And this might have been semi-interesting had we not already seen Manic unmasked a million times before. I just thought this whole thing was stupid. Then we had Storm and the great Sonata defeating Austin Aries and Tajiri, or as Steve Austin used to refer to him, Tajiri. Remember when Tajiri dressed up as Santa Claus and Austin sat on his lap? He kept calling him Tajiri Claus. I miss that redneck. Tajiri put Sonata in the tarantula. Storm spit beer in Tajiri's face. Sonata pinned him with the buzzsaw kick. Backstage, Gail Kim was looking for Havoc and found her. They brawled into the aisleway. Security had to break the two of them up. Havoc launched one of the security guards like a small child, just threw him aside, and chokeslammed the other one on the floor. She looked like a monster here, which was the point, so I thought that it worked. It was effective. I mean, here's hoping that Havoc and Gail Kim have as much chemistry as Kim did with Awesome Kong, because if they do, we're in for a real treat. And in the main event, the Hardys beat the Dudleys and the Wolves in a three-way tables match to even the series up with one win apiece for the Hardys and the Dudleys. With the champions being the odd men out, Davey Richards and Eddie Edwards do not have a win yet. They have to win this next match or else they lose the straps. Another terrible doomsday device in this match, by the way, by Bully and Devon. I just wish they would stop using it. Other than that, this was a really fun match. Lots of action. Way too much to recap here, but it ended with Jeff Hardy delivering a Swanton Bomb to Eddie Edwards off the top rope through a table on the floor. I think Eddie took the fall to the 3D the week before, also, if I remember correctly. So he is officially the Kazarian of this team. Afterwards, the Hardys said next week at No Surrender, their third match would be a ladder match. So like I said, this was real good, best thing on the entire show. So this Wednesday is No Surrender, live and free on Spike TV with Lashley and Rude for the TNA World Heavyweight title, the Hardys, the Dudleys, and the Wolves in a three-way ladder match, and Samoa Joe facing Homicide for the X Division Championship. Still no hint, by the way, of anything for Bound for Glory in Japan, which is now 4 weeks away. Their supposed biggest show of the year. I have no idea. I'm stumped as far as what the main event could be. Lashley against somebody for the title, I guess? Maybe a multi-man match? I honestly don't know. And if the idea is for the Wolves, let's say, to win match number three, and they're all knotted up, it would make sense then, if it got that far, for them to do the tie-breaking match at Bound for Glory. And there's still questions about Jeff Hardy, because Jeff Hardy in the past has not been able to travel overseas on the UK tours because he's a convicted felon. He's got a record in this country. So is that still going to be a problem? And if he can't be there, that would be a very big problem. So there's a lot of questions still that have to be answered as far as Bound for Glory is concerned. Let's move on to the mailbag here. If you got questions for me, you can send them to thesolemonster@gmail.com. Please include your name and where you are from when you write in. And you could also send MP3 audio questions as attachments. Try to keep them to 30 seconds or less if possible. This week's audio question comes to us from Davis in Phoenix, Arizona.
Greetings, Solemonster. This is Davis from Phoenix, Arizona. Now, if you were a wrestler and you were getting a big push in your career and you had the option of picking to have one of the longest title reigns in WWE history or having a big title win at WrestleMania and the other one you could never have in your career, which one would you pick?
That's an interesting question. If I had the choice of the two, I would go with the longer reign in history, one of the longest reigns in history, because I look at WWE and some of the longest reigns in history, Bruno, Hogan, Cena, right? Those are some pretty big names right there. Those are guys that made a shitload of money. So the idea is that if I'm going to be the champion, let's say, for a full year, for 2 years, okay, CM Punk is another example, 434 days, then in theory what that means is I'm going to be featured more prominently, more consistently, every week, every month. I'll be, if not the main event, certainly one of the top two matches on every single pay-per-view. I'm going to make more money. I'm going to have the chance to work with more guys, because it gets boring working against the same people over and over again. So if I'm going to have a lengthy run, that means I'm working with a whole bunch of different opponents. I'm going to have a lot of TV time. WWE has done a great job over the years of making WrestleMania out to be this grand show, the end-all, be-all. At the end of the day, though, it's still just a show. And you can pick guys. Look at The Miz. The Miz main evented WrestleMania one year, and he won. To his credit, he walked in as champion, he walked out as champion. But The Miz headlined a WrestleMania. Where's The Miz now? You know what I mean? Like, if I'm going to be a real pro wrestler and I want to have longevity and tenure on top as a wrestler and do it for as long as I can and make as much money as possible, the only place to be is the champion for an extended period of time. You win the title and you hold on to it for as long as humanly possible. You get out of it whatever you can. And that, to me, is what it's all about, you know? It's not just about one match on one night. It's about the length of your run. Anybody, any schmuck can win a title. That's why I laugh when people say, this so-and-so should be in the WWE Hall of Fame because, look, he won so many titles. First of all, it's not a legitimate Hall of Fame, so you can't really look at it that way. There are a lot of guys who deserve to be in the Hall of Fame who never held a championship. Jake the Snake Roberts went into the WWE Hall of Fame, so we're not counting his time in Georgia or anywhere else. When did Jake Roberts ever hold a title in WWE? Never. He never did. Does that mean he doesn't deserve to be in the Hall of Fame? So I think people put too much of an emphasis on that sort of thing. Oh, how many titles you won. To me, it's a lot more impressive if you win the belt once and hold on to it for 2 years than John Cena, for example, who won the belt 15 times. Ric Flair, 16 times. Well, when you hear something like that, yeah, that means he also lost it 16 times, right? So to me, it's more impressive if you have a longer run, and you can make more money that way. So that's what I would go with. Sean from Colorado. Vince McMahon has been called a hypocrite by many former executives and talent in shoot interviews. His statements to the talent and the fans, the PR spin, the rewriting of history and documentaries, does not hold water. He also has done some really messed up stuff, like hiring people, then humiliating them, and then firing them. Let's see if we could shorten this here a little bit. He is ruthless, smart, yes, but ruthless. Also has a seemingly distorted point of view. WWE booking is inconsistent, not logical most of the time. It turns off most viewers from the product. Well, I don't know about that. I mean, they still pull 4.5 million people every week. You can say the booking is shitty, but that's the problem. That's the problem right there. It's not turning off enough people. So there's no incentive for them to make it any less shitty than it already is. Triple H, before he became an executive, was accused of burying many rising stars. In the past, wrestlers who could have become big stars were arbitrarily buried and or punished for doing what Vince says, grabbing the brass ring. This has also been pointed out by many former WWE people, talent who have been de-pushed, mishandled, and or worse. These stars are over, have talent, the it factor, yet are prevented from rising above a certain level. Look at what's happening to the Wyatts, what happened to Ziggler, Barrett, Drew McIntyre, RVD, Test Rikishi, and others. Now look at how Triple H is trying to protect rising stars, how he books on NXT. It's nothing like Vince. It's starting to look like superstars that Triple H wants to protect and grow are being mishandled on the main roster. Is Vince McMahon the real reason that WWE has gone downhill? Not Triple H or any politicking stars like Hogan, Cena, and the above. In other words, is Paul Levesque's bad reputation amongst fans misdirected or just wrong? If it wasn't for Triple H, would legends like Warrior, Bruno, and others be making peace with WWE? That, first of all, you're all over the place with this question. You tackle three or four different things here, one that doesn't even have anything to do with the other. Yes, if it wasn't for Triple H, they would not have made peace with Bruno. They would not have made peace, most likely, with the Warrior, because Vince had already tried dealing with these people before. And these people basically said, fuck off, we don't like you. And so he had given up. That's what Triple H tells the story about wanting to talk to Bruno. And Vince is kind of like, well, hey, give it your best shot. Do whatever you want to do if you want to waste your time. I think that was what Vince said to Triple H. If you want to waste your time, then go right ahead. Because Vince had already given up on the idea that Bruno wanted to have anything to do with him or the company. The heat was between Vince and Bruno. Triple H stepped in kind of as the peaceful intermediary, and they made something happen. So yeah, if it wasn't for him, Warrior and Bruno and maybe even some others wouldn't have come back into the fold. But that's a completely separate issue. Is it because of Vince? Look, whatever you see on TV, that's Vince McMahon's product. Nothing that makes television happens without Vince McMahon signing off on it. Whether it's his idea or it's an idea that the writing team or Triple H pitches to him, the one thing we do know is that Vince is the end-all, be-all. Triple H says it in every single interview that he does. When people try to compliment him and say, one day you're going to take over, or we love what you're doing with NXT, and why, you know, can't the main product be that way? And he says, at the end of the day, it's Vince's vision. You know, what he says goes. If Vince McMahon goes to The Undertaker 4 hours, according to Shawn Michaels, before the Undertaker-Lesnar match at WrestleMania and says, you're losing this match, then guess what? You're losing this match. And that's just the way it is, because he's the boss. You can argue with him, you can try to give him your point of view, and maybe you can even convince him to come around to your point of view, but if not, you do what you're told to do, because that's what you do. When you go to work, you do what your boss tells you to do, no matter what you think of your boss. And if you don't like it, quit. That's how life works. So whatever you see on television is Vince's vision. What we've seen lately is a lot of really bad stuff. Bad acting, things that don't make any sense. And that's on Vince. That's not on anybody else but Vince McMahon. So yeah, you can blame him for a lot of that stuff. But when there's good stuff, you can blame him for that too. When The Shield was kicking ass every single week, and they were having those awesome matches in The Shield and the Wyatt feud, it was Vince. So you can't say when we have the Bella Twins and Jerry Springer in the ring, fuck Vince McMahon, this old fart, he's out of touch, he should step down. And then when The Shield and the Wyatt family are going at it and everyone's creaming themselves, you can say, God bless Triple H! Triple H is our savior! Like, it's Vince. Like, you can't have it both ways. You gotta blame him for the good and you gotta blame him for the bad. It just so happens that lately there's been more bad than good. They've been in this funk ever since SummerSlam. And some of you guys would say that it goes back even further than that. I would say since SummerSlam. Because there was some real good stuff to build up heading into that pay-per-view. Ever since then, I have been unimpressed and uninspired by anything that we've seen on Raw. Anything. So, will things be different when Triple H ascends to that position if he takes over one day from Vince? I hope so. If NXT is any indication, I think the future is in good hands, but who knows? You know, there's a big difference between running an entire company and running the main roster and being responsible for a television show on USA Network that 4.5 million people tune into every week and trying to maintain that audience, as opposed to going down to Full Sail University a few times a month and overseeing one or two people probably who write the whole show and put together some basic storylines, which is what we see on NXT, that happen to make sense. There's a lot more responsibility involved with Raw and SmackDown and the pay-per-views and everything else. I almost hate the fact that, you know, when that day comes, it would take Triple H away from NXT. But yeah, I hope that when that time comes, that things are going to change, and maybe he has a different philosophy than Vince does, and now he's the boss, and so he doesn't have to answer to the old man anymore, and he can do whatever he wants. I mean, he can bring back War Games if he wants to, right? That was the big story from years ago. Triple H is an old-school NWA guy, and he pitched the idea supposedly once to Vince about bringing War Games in, and Vince said no. He tried, he fought for it, but Vince said no. So I don't think anybody really knows. I don't know, you don't know, nobody knows. I don't even know that Triple H knows what he's going to do or how things are going to change if Vince, God forbid, were to die tomorrow and if Triple H was anointed his replacement. We just don't know. Jenkins from Denton, Texas, home of the Von Erichs. All this discussion of the Attitude Era, the Monday Night Wars, and the lean times the wrestling business is stumbling through right now made me wonder, where is Ted Turner these days? I actually researched and found out that he's herding bison on huge ranches wherever he's been in between philanthropic endeavors. He's 75 years old and I guess retired from the corporate world, but he's got $2.2 billion, according to Forbes. Now, I haven't seen any Ted Turner shoot interviews, and all the business documentaries and profiles featuring him, there's little mention of WCW, if any. So maybe he's done with wrestling, but he can buy TNA outright if he wanted to, and with enough change, buy ROH. Is there a snowball's chance in hell he would buy? He purchased one dwindling promotion before. Would a Ted Turner return to the business world, or the wrestling world, bring the industry back to boom times? No. No, that's just oversimplifying it. I mean, look, Ted Turner, first of all, you mentioned $2.2 billion. I'm pretty sure Ted Turner has sworn to, I think, donate, if not all of that, like a billion of it, to charity, and I think is already doing so. because he's big into the philanthropy stuff, you know, like Bill Gates is, and you know, Warren Buffett and all those people. So there is that. He has not been involved in wrestling for a long time. Even when WCW was still alive, some people don't realize that. It's not like WCW went out of business and so Ted Turner was out of wrestling. Ted Turner was out of wrestling long before WCW went out of business. And a lot of that had to do, I think, with the AOL-Time Warner merger. And that was when Turner started to see a lot of his power contract. And eventually he was pushed out. You know, he used to be this big wig, this big media mogul. And especially, you know, when the merger happened, it was he got squeezed out. That's basically what happened. Squeezed out of CNN and all of those things. And marginalized to the point where he didn't really have any power anymore. I mean, he would still do interviews and people, you know, some people took his viewpoints as, you know, meaningful in some way. Here's a guy who used to be, you know, on top of the world, and now let's see what he has to say about this, that, or the other. But he didn't really have any power. Ted Turner was kind of ignored at that point and wasn't really taken seriously anymore. Now, if he wanted to get back into wrestling, he could do whatever he wants because he's got the money and he's got the resources. I mean, look at all these companies that are sprouting up now. If Ted Turner picked up the phone and called Jeff Jarrett and said, "Hey, Jeff, you know, I want to get back in the wrestling business," and I'm sure Jeff Jarrett would gladly take Ted Turner's money. But that's not going to happen. Ted Turner had a soft spot in his heart for wrestling because the wrestling programming on the Superstation in the early 80s is what really lifted that channel to prominence. And without the wrestling, who knows if that channel would have succeeded. So that's why he kept his involvement in wrestling and kept it going, because he had a soft spot for it. And, you know, I don't know that that really matters to him anymore. I think he, you know, he probably feels once WCW went away, that was the last link. You know, he's not even affiliated with the Superstation anymore. You know, it's like a previous life. He's living a completely different life now, almost like a life of obscurity. He's not really involved in that world anymore. And like you said, he's 75 years old. He's retired. He's in his twilight years. Why would he want to get back into wrestling? Why would he care? If he wanted to compete with Vince McMahon, then, you know, I guess he could do whatever he wants. He could certainly compete. Vince, I always felt Vince really built it up as more than it was. Like, Ted Turner wanted to compete with me, and it was this blood feud. I don't know. I mean, I never got the impression that Ted Turner was like, "We got to put Vince McMahon out of business, you know, this son of a bitch." I always felt like that was Vince's narrative, and it was just built up to be more than it really was. But the biggest reason, just to go back to the original question, and the biggest reason why it would not return the industry to boom times or anything like that, is that he has no television anymore. He doesn't run the Superstation or TNT or any of those channels. He is completely out. And that was the reason why Eric Bischoff's investors pulled out when Bischoff thought he had WCW in his back pocket and he was going to buy him in 01. Once they took the TV slots away from them, it was dead. And the investors pulled out. And Vince swooped in and picked up the whole thing. And picked up, you know, he picked the bones. Because without TV, it was worthless. So unless Ted Turner has television, he's not really doing a whole hell of a lot for TNA or ROH. For TNA, it would keep them alive. So yes, in the case of TNA, it would be meaningful. Because if they had the money, then all this talk about going out of business would go away. And they could afford to keep people. And they could afford to actually bring in some big stars. And pay people an actual salary instead of paying them per appearance and all that nonsense. So for them, it would be a meaningful change. But Ted Turner coming in has nothing to do with, you know, TNA staying on Spike. Spike is done with TNA. And it's not like Ted Turner has the magic touch and he's going to be able to talk to his network friends and get impact on FX or AMC or TBS. He can't do that. Ring of Honor is already run by a multi-million dollar media company who, even though they have the resources, apparently doesn't want to allocate those resources to ROH. That's a Sinclair issue. There's nothing Ted Turner can do about that. You know, he could buy Ring of Honor and upgrade their production. That's all great. What about TV? He doesn't have that anymore. So without that, there's not much Turner can do. Ryan Leff, my question is about Raw in 2006. For me, that's my favorite year in wrestling, simply because that was when I first was introduced to WWE. What was your favorite moment from that year on Raw? I was not a fan of Raw during that period of 06, 07, 08. You know, it just, it was okay. I don't look at that as like the real exciting good years of Raw. And to be honest with you, I don't remember much from Raw back in 2006, except, and I'll go with this moment simply because I remember it, and I remember it being very good, the Edge-Ric Flair TLC match, which I think was for the WWE Championship. That was a really fun match, and it was a lot better than it had any right to be. You know, the idea that you're going to put Ric Flair in a TLC match, singles TLC match, and have him climbing ladders and shit is just preposterous. But to his credit and to Edge's credit, because Edge helped him out, they went out there and they had a really good, really fun match. And that was one of the things that I think stands out to me most about Raw from that year. In fact, it's the only thing about Raw that year that stands out to me. Off the top of my head, I just can't remember any other big thing that happened that made me go, hey, that was great. I mean, maybe there was some great matches, but those years, they just kind of blend together for me, you know? It doesn't really stand out to me for any other reason. So I'll go with that. David from California, I wanted your thoughts on wrestlers' movesets these days. Seems like everybody I watch from PWG, ROH, WWE, and to a lesser extent TNA, is a high flyer, and I think it's pretty ridiculous. If everybody is a high flyer, then nobody is a high flyer. The dive through the ropes is overdone as hell, and everybody and their mother does Hurricane Ranas, including Goldust now. I plan on becoming a wrestler myself someday, maybe a high flyer, as I find the... Well, there you go. You're part of the problem. He says, but seeing all these high spots, flips, and kicks makes me think the only way to become popular is to be a high flyer. I think part of it is just because the bar has been set so high now. You have a guy like Adrian Neville going out there doing the Red Arrow. You know, if you're Heath Slater or The Miz going on after an Adrian Neville match, good luck. Good luck. That's all I can say. So you've got to find other ways to compensate and be interesting and be exciting and get the crowd behind you. It's hard, man. It's hard when these guys go out there, the X Division, right, and TNA. I mean, you can't do what those guys do. So you've just got to find other ways to stand out. So I think that's part of it. The bar has just been set so high. I have to say, though, I am in 100% agreement with David about the dives, and I've made that comment on the podcast before. I think it's ridiculous. Every single person now does these dives. You have the Wyatt family. You have Luke Harper. Now, it looks really impressive when Luke Harper does it because he's a big guy. So I guess, you know, for him, it works, but the idea that Luke Harper does dives through the ropes, the Usos do dives through the ropes, Goldust is doing flips and dives through the ropes, and I think Goldust is great. I think it's great to see a year later he's still with the company. He's moving around. He's doing his thing. I think it's great. But the diving through the ropes, I am in complete agreement with David. It just feels like everybody does them now. Everybody. We see the same thing on NXT. You saw the same thing on TakeOver. Everybody does that dive, that suicide torpedo dive through the ropes. So it's not special anymore. You know, Daniel Bryan used to do it all the time. Seth Rollins does it. They need to cut back on that. Absolutely. Absolutely. Dan from Surrey, England. I was flicking through some videos on YouTube and came across the best of CM Punk commentary 2010. I started watching wrestling again in 2011 after stopping around 2003, therefore missing this section of the product. Do you feel CM Punk may return in a few years as a commentator, much like Randy Savage, Jesse Ventura, or JBL? No. No, I don't. Craig wants to know, do you think WWE might release Solomon Crowe due to the fact that they don't really know what to do with him? He's a great wrestler with decent mic skills and could possibly have an awesome feud with Dean Ambrose. I just hate to see another great talent like him thrown away by WWE. I think you're overreacting big time here. He hasn't even debuted yet. They did the hacker gimmick. Supposedly Triple H didn't like the hacker gimmick, so that's been dropped. So they're trying to find something, or he himself is trying to find a character, a voice for himself. If they didn't want him there, they never would have signed him in the first place. They signed him for a reason. They obviously liked him. They brought him in. I mean, if they're going to cut him, they're not going to cut him until after he's already had a chance to go out there and work. And if it doesn't work, then they get rid of him. Or if he fucks up outside the ring, they'll get rid of him. You know, the guy hasn't even made his debut yet. He's been down in developmental for so long, and I don't think it's because he's no good or because he needed a lot of training. It's probably just They're waiting for their moment. They're waiting to pick their spot. Now he's hurt. I know he chipped a bone, I think, in his leg, his tibia or something. He doesn't need surgery, so he may be out for a little while. But when he comes back and they have an idea for him, I think we'll see him. We'll see him on NXT. I don't think he's in any real jeopardy in being cut right now. Look at Corey Graves. Corey Graves, unfortunately, has suffered one too many concussions, and his in-ring career may be over. WWE does not want him wrestling. So they're probably thinking of, okay, how can we use this guy? Maybe a guy like Corey Graves ends up doing announcing, you know, or managing or something else. But if they see value in you, they brought these guys in, they see some value in them, then they'll find something for them to do. I just think you're overreacting. And finally, Randy from Tampa, Florida. Do you think Ring of Honor does itself a disservice by refusing to work with great talent they deem difficult and or unprofessional? The recent troubles with both Michael Elgin and ACH got me thinking that if they were released from the company, they could face the same fate as Low Ki, who received a lifetime ban from the organization back in 2006. Initially, I thought the ban was simply being utilized to further a potential storyline that would see Low Ki make his return and feud with the commissioner, Jim Cornette. However, after learning of Low Ki's issues behind the scenes with management and the fact that he has yet to return to ROH, it appears that the ban was legit. Same can be said for Davey Richards and Kenny King, as both wrestlers had less than graceful exits from the company, leading one to believe that if TNA were to indeed go under, neither man would be welcome back. Should ROH be more forgiving in situations like this in order to provide fans the best talent available, or do you think they are justified in trying to ensure an environment of professionalism to uphold their code of honor? I see what you did there at the end, by the way. I think that Ring of Honor should just hire people or get rid of people, you know, as they see fit. It's their company. They can do whatever they want. If they had issues with Low Ki before, and it's not like there haven't been stories of Low Ki being difficult to work with, then that's their prerogative. I don't remember if they had him, he left, and they brought him back and gave him a second chance or not. Especially if they already gave him a second chance, then if they don't want to bring him back, then they don't have to bring him back. You know, it's not like some public service. It's a private company. They could do whatever the hell they want. And there are some guys who, if they don't do the right thing or they're a nuisance to deal with, then they go on a list. So you don't have to deal with them anymore. For every guy that may end up on the shit list, you know, it's not like there's no shortage of great talent out there that Ring of Honor has or can bring in. If they have a performer who fucks up in some way and now it's like, well, we don't want to work with him anymore. So you go find somebody else who can be just as good as that guy, who's also a great wrestler. You know, you don't owe it to the fans. Well, the fans like the guy, and so we may as well bring him back. No, I mean, if I'm running Ring of Honor and the guy is a pain in the ass, then fuck him. I'm not going to work with him. And then you'll also have guys who don't get along with other wrestlers, and maybe they're causing problems behind the scenes. They're a cancer in the locker room. That's not good either. You want to make sure that you have a locker room in harmony, and there isn't a lot of infighting and problems, and this guy's an asshole, and now they're fighting, and you don't want that. You have to make sure you maintain, what was the expression you use? An environment of professionalism? The code of honor? You call it whatever the hell you want. I mean, you don't want to have problems behind the scenes. If there's somebody who's causing a problem, you eliminate the problem. It's very simple. So it's their company. They could do whatever they want, and I probably would do the same thing. If you have questions for the mailbag, please email me, thesolemonster@gmail.com. These were great. And I know that you guys are sending me a whole ton of questions. I'm way behind. I'm trying to catch up. But keep sending them in, and you never know when your question may get read out loud here on the air. That includes MP3 audio questions. You can send those in to me as well. Follow me on Twitter, @Solomonster is my official handle. I will be live tweeting Raw this Monday night, as I always do. And I got to say, as long and painful as these shows have been and can be, I mean, this week was a little bit better. It's actually kind of nice to be able to live tweet back and forth with you guys. It makes the 3 hours pass that much quicker. I think it probably the same way with you guys, I think. It takes your mind off some of the garbage that we have to sit through to get to the good stuff on these shows. So follow me on there, @Solomonster. Facebook.com/TheSolomonster is the address for my profile. You can also apply for membership in our closed discussion group. Type in Solomonster Sounds Off. You'll find our fan page, which you could like, and you'll find the group, and you can apply for membership there. We are now over 9,300 subscribers on YouTube on our channel, so if you are not subscribed there, please go ahead and subscribe. We have a couple of recent Sound Off inbox episodes up there answering your questions, all mailbag questions. I hope to do more of those in the future, so hit us up on there. And please consider buying a t-shirt, prowrestlingtees.com/Solomonster Sounds Off. We sold a few shirts this week. We still have a ways to go. Again, we have to hit a certain number within the next 2 months or so in order to be able to upload more designs and just, frankly, just maintain the store on the website. So it's very important that if you guys are going to buy a shirt, you got four designs up there right now to choose from, including the official Sound Off logo t-shirt. We need your help, so please do consider buying a shirt. And if you do, take a picture of it, send it in, and maybe I'll post it up on Twitter. So prowrestlingtees.com/Solomonster. And you can also support the show by making a PayPal donation on thesolomonster.com, or you can also sign up for a free Audible trial, audibletrial.com/Solomonster. That doesn't cost you a thing. That is totally free. You get one free audio book. Only if your trial extends beyond the 30 days, which if it does, I assume that means you like the service, then you would pay for it. But you are under no obligation to do so. You can just sample it, see if you like it, grab an audiobook, and if you don't like it, like I said, you can cancel it and keep the book. So audibletrial.com/Solomonster. That's our custom URL. Please pass that around to friends and family if you know somebody who might be interested in an audiobook. They're great if you're on the go, at the gym, if you commute. If you think they might be interested and want to check it out, use our URL, and you'll be helping out the podcast by doing so. So that's going to wrap up episode 345 this week. We're going to cut things a little bit short here because I have to be somewhere else. So we will be back next weekend with episode 346, Night of Champions predictions for the big pay-per-view coming up a week from now, and any other big breaking news stories. It just seems like every week there's something new to talk about in wrestling, so I'm sure we'll have plenty to discuss. Until then, be well, stay safe, thank you as always for your amazing support, and we will see you right back here next week for more Sound Off. Until then, take care, guys.
The good, the bad, and the ugly. The Solomonster Sounds Off.
Jonathan writes in, Sheamus and Dean Ambrose don't defend their U.S. title for weeks and how the titles mean shit. Let me school you, son. There's a big difference now, today, between the world title and the secondary titles. WWE has done a horrendous job. So they lose and they lose and they lose, and soon enough, people look at them as losers who happen to carry around a belt. That's not how you make your title seem important. Your champion should look strong. So now that I shot down your argument there, if Brock comes back and defends the title at Survivor Series, and then again at the Rumble, and again at Mania, the world will not end. Business will not die. But I guarantee you, those Brock Lesnar title defenses are going to be must-see TV when they happen. So, eat your sour grapes and just relax.
The Solomonster Sounds Off.
Since 2007, on thesolomonster.com, Stitcher Radio, and iTunes.
Solomonster Sound Off.